filled for returnable cans and bottles. And although his aura did not look as healthy as that of the fellow they had met out by the old train yards earlier, Ralph reckoned he would do in a pinch, which for Lois this definitely was. Clotho,
we'll see that he wanders over this way, Ralph. We don't have much power over the physical aspects of the short-time world, but I think we can manage that much.
You sure?
Yes.
Okay, good. Ralph took a quick look at the two little men, noted their anxious, frightened eyes, and nodded. Then he bent and kissed Lois's cool, wrinkled cheek. She gave him the smile of a tired old grandmother. I did that to her, he thought. Me.
Then you better make sure you didn't do it for nothing,
Carolyn's voice responded tartly. Ralph gave the three of them, Clotho and Lachesis, were now flanking Lois protectively on the bench, a final glance, and then began to walk down the hill again. When he reached the toilets, he stood between them for a moment, then leaned his head against the one marked Women. He heard nothing when he tipped his head against the blue plastic wall of Men. However, he heard a faint, droning voice raised in song.
Who believes that my wildest dreams and my craziest schemes will come true? You, baby, nobody but you.
Christ, he's nuttier than a fruitcake. This is news, sweetheart? Ralph supposed it wasn't. He walked around to the door of the Portisan and opened it. Now he could also hear the distant, waspy buzz of an airplane engine. But there was nothing to see that he hadn't seen dozens of times before. The cracked toilet seat resting askew over the hole in the seat. A roll of toilet paper with a strange and somehow ominous swelled look. And to the left, a urinal that looked like a plastic teardrop. The walls were tangles of graffiti. The largest and most exuberant had been printed in foot-high red letters above the urinal. Tony Boynton has got the tightest little buns in Derry. A cloying pine-scented deodorizer overlay the smells of shit, piss, and lingering wino farts like makeup on the face of a corpse. The voice he was hearing seemed to come from the hole in the center of the Portisan's bench seat. Or perhaps it was seeping out of the very walls.
From the time I fall asleep until the morning comes, I dream about you, baby, nobody but you.
Where is he? Ralph wondered. And how the hell do I get to him? Ralph felt sudden heat against his hip. It was as if someone had slipped a warm coal into his watch pocket. He began to frown, then remembered what was in there. He reached into the scrap of a pocket with one finger, touched the gold band he had stowed there, and hooked it out. He laid it on his palm, over the place where his love line and lifeline diverged, and poked at it gingerly. It had cooled again. Ralph found he wasn't very surprised. HD ED 8587. One ring to rule them all, one ring to bind them. Ralph murmured and slipped Ed's wedding band onto the third finger of his own left hand. It was a perfect fit. He pushed it up until it clinked softly against the wedding ring Carolyn had put onto his own finger some 45 years ago. Then he looked up and saw that the back wall of the Portisan had disappeared. What he saw, framed by the walls which did remain, was a just-past sunset sky and a swatch of Maine countryside fading into a blue-gray twilight haze. He estimated that he was looking out from a height of about 10,000 feet. He could see glimmering lakes and ponds and vast stretches of dark green woodland scrolling down toward the Portisan's bench seat and then disappearing. Far ahead, up toward the roof of the toilet cubicle, Ralph could see a glimmering nest of lights. That was probably Derry, now no more than 10 minutes away. In the lower left quadrant of this vision, Ralph could see part of an instrument panel. Taped over the altimeter was a small color photograph that stopped his breath. It was Helen, looking impossibly happy and impossibly beautiful. Cradled in her arms was the exalted and revered baby, fast asleep and no more than 4 months old. He wants them to be the last thing he sees in this world, Ralph thought. He's been turned into a monster, but I guess even monsters don't forget how to love. Something on the instrument panel began to beep. A hand came into view and flicked a switch. Before it disappeared, Ralph could see the white indentation on the third finger of that hand, faint but still visible, where the wedding ring had rested for at least 6 years. He saw something else as well. The aura surrounding the hand was the same as the one which had surrounded the thunderstruck baby in the hospital elevator, a turbulent, rapidly moving membrane that seemed as alien as the atmosphere of a gas giant. Ralph looked back once and raised his hand. Clotho and Lachesis raised theirs in return. Lois blew him a kiss. Ralph made a catching gesture, then turned and stepped into the portazan. He hesitated for a moment, wondering what to do about the bench seat, then remembered the oncoming hospital gurney, which should have crushed their skulls but hadn't, and walked toward the back of the cubicle. He clenched his teeth, preparing to bark his shin. What you knew was one thing, what you believed after 70 years of bumping into stuff quite another, and then stepped through the bench seat as if it were made of smoke, or as if he were. There was a scary sensation of weightlessness and vertigo, and for a moment he was sure he was going to vomit. This was accompanied by a feeling of drain, as if much of the power he had taken in from Lois was now being siphoned off. He supposed it was. This was a form of teleportation, after all, fabulous science fiction stuff, and something like that had to use up a lot of energy. The vertigo passed, but it was replaced by a perception that was even worse, a feeling that he had been split at the neck somehow. He realized he now had a completely unobstructed view of a whole sprawling section of the world. Jesus Christ, what's happened to me? What's wrong? His senses reluctantly reported back that there was nothing wrong exactly. It was just that he had achieved a position which should have been impossible. He was 73 inches tall. The cockpit of the plane was 60 inches from floor to ceiling. This meant that any pilot much bigger than Clotho and Lachesis had to slouch his way to his seat. Ralph, however, had entered the plane not only while it was in flight, but while he was standing up, and he was still standing up, between and slightly behind the two seats in the cockpit. The reason his view was unobstructed was both simple and horrible. His head was sticking out of the top of the plane. Ralph had a nightmare image of his old dog Rex, who'd like to ride with his head out the passenger window and his raggedy ears blowing back in the slipstream. He closed his eyes. What if I fall? If I can stick my head out through the damn roof, what's to keep me from sliding right down through the floor and falling all the way to the ground? Or maybe through the ground, and then through the very earth itself? But that wasn't happening, and nothing like it would happen, not on this level. All he had to do was remember the effortless way they'd risen through the floors of the hospital, and the ease with which they'd stood on the roof. If he kept those things in mind, he would be okay. Ralph tried to center on that idea, and when he felt quite sure he had himself under control, he opened his eyes again. Sloping out just below him was the plane's windshield. Beyond it was the nose, tipped with a quick silver blur of propeller. The nestle of lights he had observed from the door of the portazan was closer now. Ralph bent his knees, and his head slid smoothly through the ceiling of the cockpit. For a moment, he could taste oil in his mouth, and the tiny hairs in his nose seemed to bristle as if with an electric shock, and then he was kneeling between the pilot's and co-pilot's seats. He didn't know what he had expected to feel, seeing Ed again after all this time and under such extravagantly weird circumstances, but the pang of regret, not just pity, but regret, which came was a surprise. He was wearing an old T-shirt instead of an Oxford or Arrow, with buttons up the front and a fruit loop on the back. And it had had an extraordinary effect, making him look not emaciated, but somehow heroic, in a gothic, romantic way. Ralph was forcefully reminded of Carolyn's favorite poem, The Highwayman by Alfred Noyes. Ed's skin was as pale as paper, his green eyes both dark and light, like emeralds in moonlight, Ralph thought, behind the small, round John Lennon spectacles, his lips so red they looked as if they'd been rouged. He had tied the white silk scarf with its red Japanese characters around his forehead,
so that the fringed ends trailed down his back. Within the thunderbolt swirls of his aura, Ed's intelligent, mobile face was filled with terrible regret and fierce determination. He was beautiful, beautiful, and Ralph felt a sense of déjà vu twist through him. Now he knew what he had glimpsed on the day he'd stepped between Ed and the man from Westside Gardeners. He was seeing it again. Looking at Ed, lost inside a typhoon aura from which no balloon string floated, was like looking at a priceless Ming vase which had been thrown against a wall and shattered. At least he can't see me, not on this level. At least I don't think he can. As if in response to this thought, Ed turned and glanced directly at Ralph. His eyes were wide and full of mad caution. The corners of his finely molded mouth quivered and gleamed with buds of saliva. Ralph recoiled, momentarily positive that he was being seen. But Ed didn't react to Ralph's sudden backward movement. He threw a suspicious glance into the empty four-seat passenger cabin behind him instead, as if he had heard the stealthy movements of a stowaway. At the same time, he reached past Ralph and put his right hand on a cardboard carton which had been seat-belted into the co-pilot's chair. The hand caressed the box briefly, then went to his forehead and made some tiny adjustment to the scarf serving him as a headband. That done, he resumed singing. Only this time it was a different song, one that sent a tremor zigzagging up Ralph's back. One pill makes you bigger, one pill makes you small, and the ones that Mother gives you don't do anything at all. Right, Ralph thought. Go ask Alice when she's 10 feet tall. His heart was trip-hammering in his chest. Having Ed suddenly turn around like that had scared him in a way, even finding himself riding along at 10,000 feet with his head sticking out of the top of the plane hadn't been able to do. Ed didn't see him. Ralph was almost positive of that. But whoever had said that the senses of lunatics were more acute than those of the sane must have known what he was talking about, because Ed sure had an idea that something had changed. The radio squawked, making both men jump.
This is for the Cherokee over South Haven. You're on the edge of Derry airspace at an altitude which requires a filed flight plan. Repeat. You're about to enter a controlled airspace over a municipal area. Get your hot-dogging butt up to 16,000 feet, Cherokee, and come to 170. That's 170. While you're doing it, please identify yourself and state...
Ed closed his hand into a fist and began to hammer the radio with it. Glass flew. Soon blood also began to fly. It spattered the instrument panel, the picture of Helen and Natalie, and Ed's clean gray T-shirt. He went on hammering until the voice on the radio first began to fade into a rising roar of static, and then quit altogether. Good, he said, in the low, sighing voice of a man who talks to himself a lot. Lots better. I hate all those questions. They just... He caught sight of his bloody hand and broke off. He held it up, looked at it more closely, and then rolled it into a fist again. A large sliver of glass was sticking out of his pinky just below the third knuckle. Ed pulled it free with his teeth, spat it casually aside, then did something which chilled Ralph's heart. Drew the side of his bloody fist first down his left cheek and then his right, leaving a pair of red marks. He reached into the elasticized pocket built into the wall on his left, pulled out a hand mirror, and used it to check his makeshift war paint. What he saw seemed to please him, because he smiled and nodded before returning the mirror to the pocket.
Just remember what the Dormouse said,
Ed advised himself in his low, sighing voice, and then pushed in on the control wheel. The Cherokee's nose dropped, and the altimeter slowly began to unwind. Ralph could see Derry straight ahead now. The city looked like a handful of opals scattered across dark blue velvet. There was a hole in the side of the carton in the co-pilot's seat. Two wires came out of it. They led into the back of a doorbell taped to the arm of Ed's seat. Ralph supposed that as soon as he had a visual on the Civic Center and actually began his kamikaze run, Ed would settle one finger on the raised white button in the middle of the plastic rectangle, and just before the plane hit, he would push it. Ding-dong, Avon calling.
Break those wires, Ralph. Break them. An excellent idea with only one drawback. He couldn't break so much as a strand of cobweb while he was on this level. That meant dropping back down to short-time country. And he was preparing to do just that when a soft, familiar voice on his right spoke his name.
Ralph.
To his right? That was impossible. There was nothing on his right but the co-pilot's seat, the side of the aircraft, and leagues of twilight New England air. The scar along his arm had begun to tingle like a filament in an electric heater.
Ralph.
Don't look. Don't pay any attention at all. Ignore it. But he couldn't. Some great brick-like force had come to bear on him, and his head began to turn. He fought it, aware that the airplane's angle of descent was growing steeper, but it did no good.
Ralph, look at me. Don't be afraid.
He made one last effort to disobey the voice and was unable. His head went on turning, and Ralph suddenly found himself looking at his mother, who had died of lung cancer 25 years ago. Bertha Roberts sat in her bentwood rocker, about 5 feet beyond where the side wall of the Cherokee's cockpit had been, knitting and rocking back and forth on thin air a mile or so above the ground. The slippers Ralph had given her for her 50th birthday, lined with real mink they had been, how goofy, were on her feet. A pink shawl was thrown around her shoulders. An old political button, "Win with Wilkie," it said, held the shawl closed. That's right, Ralph thought. She wore them as jewelry. It was her little affectation. I'd forgotten that. The only thing that struck a wrong note, other than that she was dead and currently rocking at 6,000 feet, was the bright red piece of Afghan in her lap. Ralph had never seen his mother knit, wasn't even sure she knew how, but she was knitting furiously just the same. The needles gleamed and winked as they shuttled through the stitches. Mother? Mom? Is it really you? The needles paused as she looked up from the crimson blanket in her lap. Yes, it was his mother, the version Ralph remembered from his teens anyway. Narrow face, high scholar's brow, brown eyes, and a bun of salt-and-pepper hair rolled tightly at the nape of the neck. It was her small mouth, which looked mean and ungenerous until it smiled, that was. Why, Ralph Roberts, I'm surprised that you even have to ask. That's not really an answer, though, is it? Ralph thought. He opened his mouth to say so, and then decided it might be wiser, for the time being at least, to keep quiet. A milky shape was now swimming in the air to her right. When Ralph looked at it, it darkened and solidified into the cherry-stained magazine stand he had made her in Woodshop during his sophomore year at Derry High. It was filled with Reader's Digests and Life magazines. And now the ground far below her began to disappear into a pattern of brown and dark red squares that spread out from the rocker in a widening ring like a pond ripple. Ralph recognized it at once. The kitchen linoleum of the house on Richmond Street in Marymead. The one where he'd grown up. At first he could see the ground through it, geometries of farmland, and not far ahead, the Kanduskeag flowing through Derry, and then it solidified. A ghostly shape like a big milkweed puff became his mom's old Angora cat, Futsy, curled up on the windowsill and looking out at the gulls circling above the old dump in the barrens. Futsy had died around the time Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis had stopped making movies together.
That old man was right, boy. You've no business messing into long-time affairs. Pay attention to your mother and stay out of what doesn't concern you. Mind me now.
Pay attention to your mother? Mind me now? Those words had pretty well summed up Bertha Roberts's views on the art and science of child-rearing, hadn't they? Whether it was an order to wait an hour after eating before taking a swim, or to make sure that old thief Butch Bowers didn't put a lot of rotten potatoes at the bottom of the peck basket she'd sent you to fetch. The prologue, pay attention to your mother, and the epilogue, mind me now, were always the same. And if you failed to pay attention,
If you failed to mind her, you had to face the wrath of Mother, and God help you then. She picked up the needles and began to knit again, running off scarlet stitches with fingers that looked faintly red themselves. Ralph supposed that was just an illusion. Or maybe the dye wasn't completely color-fast, and some of it was coming off on his fingers. His fingers? What a silly mistake that was. Her fingers. Except, well, there were little bunches of whiskers at the corners of her mouth. Long ones. Nasty somehow. And unfamiliar. Ralph could remember a fine down on her upper lip. But whiskers? No way. Those were new. New? New? What are you thinking about? She died 2 days after Robert Kennedy was assassinated in Los Angeles. So what in the name of God can be new about her? Two converging walls had bloomed on either side of Bertha Roberts, creating the kitchen corner where she had spent so much time. On one of them was a painting Ralph remembered well. It showed a family at supper. Dad, Mom, two kids. They were passing the potatoes and the corn and looked like they were discussing their respective days. None of them noticed that there was a fifth person in the room, a white-robed man with a sandy beard and long hair. He was standing in the corner and watching them. Christ, the unseen visitor, the plaque beneath this painting read. Except the Christ Ralph remembered had looked both kind and a little embarrassed to be eavesdropping. This version, however, looked coldly thoughtful, evaluative, judgmental perhaps, and his color was very high, almost choleric, as if he had heard something which had made him furious. "Mom, are you..." She put the needles down again on the red blanket, that oddly shiny red blanket, and raised a hand to stop him.
"Mommy, no moms, Ralph. Just pay attention and mind. Stay out of this. It's too late for your muddling and meddling. You can only make things worse."
The voice was right, but the face was wrong and becoming wronger. Mostly it was her skin, smooth and unlined. Her skin had been Bertha Roberts's only vanity. The skin of the creature in the rocker was rough. More than rough, in fact. It was scaly. And there were two growths, or perhaps they were sores, on the sides of her neck. At the sight of them, some terrible memory.
"Get it off me, Johnny. Oh, please, get it off,"
stirred far down in his mind. And, well, her aura. Where was her aura?
"Never mind my aura, and never mind about that fat old whore you've been running around with. Although I'll bet Carolyn is just rolling in her grave."
The mouth of the woman, not a woman, that thing is not a woman, in the rocker was no longer small. The lower lip had spread, puffed outward and downward. The mouth itself had developed a drooping sneer, a strangely familiar drooping sneer.
"Johnny, it's biting me, it's biting me."
Something horridly familiar about the bunches of whiskers bristling at the corners of the mouth, too.
"Johnny, please, it's eyes, it's black eyes." "Johnny can't help you, boy. He didn't help you then, and he can't help you now."
Of course he couldn't. His older brother Johnny had died 6 years ago. Ralph had been a pallbearer at his funeral. Johnny had died of a heart attack, possibly as random as the one which had felled Bill McGovern, and... Ralph looked to the left, but the pilot's side of the cockpit had also disappeared, and Ed Deepnow with it. Ralph saw the old combination gas and wood stove on which his mother had cooked in the house on Richmond Street, a job she had resented bitterly and done badly all her life, and the arch leading into the dining room. He saw their maple dining table. A glass pitcher stood in the center of it. The pitcher had been filled with a choke of lurid red roses. Each seemed to have a face, a blood-red, gasping face. But that's wrong, he thought. All wrong. She'd never had roses in the house. She was allergic to most blooms, and roses were the worst. She used to sneeze like crazy when she was around them. The only thing I ever saw her put on the dining room table was Indian bouquet, and that wasn't anything but autumn grasses.
I see roses because... He looked back at the creature in the rocking chair, at red fingers which had now melted together into appendages that looked almost like fins. He regarded the scarlet mass which lay in the creature's lap, and the scar along his arm began to tingle again. What in God's name is going on here? But he knew, of course. He only had a look from the red thing in the rocking chair to the picture hanging on the wall, the picture of the scarlet-faced, malevolent Jesus watching the family eat their supper, to confirm it. He was not in his old house in Marymead, and he was not precisely in an aircraft over Derry, either. He was in the court of the Crimson King. Without thinking about why he was doing it, Ralph slipped a hand into his sweater pocket and loosely cupped one of Lois's earrings. His hand felt far away, something which belonged to someone else. He was realizing an interesting thing. He had never been frightened in his life until now. Not once. He had thought he'd been frightened, of course, but it had been an illusion. The only time he'd even come close had been in the Derry Public Library, when Charlie Pickering stuck a knife into his armpit and said he was going to let Ralph's guts out all over the floor. That, however, was nothing but a mild moment of discomfort next to what he was feeling now. A green man came. He felt good, but I could be wrong. He hoped she wasn't. He most sincerely hoped she wasn't, because the green man was about all he had left now. The green man and Lois's earrings.
Ralph, stop wool-gathering. Look at your mother when she's talking to you. 70 years old, and you still act like you were 16, with a bad case of pecker rash.
He turned back to the red-finned thing slumped in the rocker. It now bore only a passing resemblance to his late mother.
You're not my mother, and I'm still in the airplane. You're not, boy. Don't make the mistake of thinking you are. Take one step out of my kitchen and you're in for a very long fall. You might as well stop now. I can see what you are.
The thing spoke in a bubbly, choked voice that turned Ralph's spine to a narrow line of ice.
You don't. You may think you do, but you don't. And you don't want to. You don't ever want to see me with my disguises laid aside. Believe me, Ralph, you don't.
He realized with mounting horror that the mother thing had turned into an enormous female catfish, a hungry bottom feeder, with stubby teeth gleaming between its pendulous lips, and whiskers which dangled almost to the collar of the dress it still wore. The gills in its neck opened and closed like razor cuts, revealing troubled red inner flesh. Its eyes had grown round and purplish, and as Ralph watched, the sockets began to slide away from each other. This continued until the eyes bulged from the sides rather than the front of the creature's scaly face.
Don't move so much as a single muscle, Ralph. You'll probably die in the explosion, no matter what level you're on. The shock waves travel here just as they do in any building. But that death will still be a great deal better than my death.
The catfish opened its mouth. Its teeth ringed a blood-colored maw, which looked full of strange guts and tumors. It seemed to be laughing at him.
Who are you? Are you the Crimson King? That's Ed's name for me. We ought to have our own, don't you think? Let's see. If you don't want me to be Mom Roberts, why I'll call me the Kingfish. You remember the Kingfish from the radio, don't you?
Yes, of course he did. But the real kingfish had never been on Amos and Andy, and it hadn't really been a kingfish at all. The real kingfish had been a queenfish, and it had lived in the barrens. On a summer's day during the year when Ralph Roberts was 7, he had hooked an enormous catfish out of the Kanduskeag while fishing with his brother John. This had been when it was still possible to eat what you caught down in the barrens. Ralph had asked his older brother to take the convulsively flopping thing off his hook for him and put it in the bucket of fresh water they kept on the bank beside them. Johnny had refused, loftily citing what he called the fisherman's creed. Good fishermen tie their own flies, dig their own worms, and unhook their own catches. It was only later that Ralph realized Johnny might have been trying to hide his own fear of the huge and somehow alien creature his kid brother had reeled out of the Kanduskeag's muddy, piss-warm water that day. Ralph had at last brought himself to grasp the catfish's pulsing body, which was at the same time slick, scaly, and prickly. As he did, Johnny had added to his terror by telling him in a low and ominous voice to look out for the whiskers. "They're poisoned. Bobby Therall told me if one of them sticks in you, you could get paralyzed. Spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. So be careful, Ralphie." Ralph had twisted the creature this way and that, trying to free the hook from its dark, wet innards without getting his hand too near its whiskers, not believing Johnny about the poison, and at the same time believing him completely. Exquisitely aware of the gills, the eyes, the fishy smell that seemed to shimmer its way more deeply into his lungs each time he inhaled. At last he'd heard a gristly ripping from deep within the catfish and felt the hook start to slide free. Fresh streamlets of blood trickled from the corners of its flexing, dying mouth. Ralph gave a little sigh of relief, prematurely as it turned out. The catfish gave a tremendous flap of its tail as the hook came out. The hand Ralph had been using to free it slipped, and all at once the catfish's bleeding mouth clamped shut on his first two fingers. How much pain had there been? A lot? Some? Maybe none at all? Ralph couldn't remember. What he did remember was Johnny's completely unfeigned shriek of horror and his own surety that the catfish was going to make him pay for taking its life by eating two fingers off his right hand. He remembered screaming himself and shaking his hand and begging Johnny to help him. But Johnny had been backing away, his face pale, his mouth a knotted line of revulsion. Ralph shook his hand in big swooping arcs, but the catfish hung on like death. Whiskers, poison whiskers, put me in a wheelchair for the rest of my life, snapping and flapping against Ralph's wrist, black eyes staring. At last he'd struck it against the nearby tree, breaking its back. It had dropped to the grass, still flopping, and Ralph had stamped on it with one foot, provoking the final horror. A spew of guts vomited from its mouth, and from the place where Ralph's heel had smashed it open had come a gluey torrent of bloody eggs. That was when he had realized that the kingfish had really been the queenfish, and only a day or two from rowing. Ralph had stared from this freakish mess to his own bloody scale-encrusted hand, and then howled like a banshee. When Johnny touched his arm in an effort to calm him, Ralph had bolted. He hadn't stopped running until he got home, and he'd refused to come out of his room for the rest of the day. It had been almost a year before he'd eaten another piece of fish, and he never had anything to do with catfish again. Until now, that was. "Ralph?" That was Lois's voice, but distant, so distant. "You have to do something right away. Don't let it stop you." Ralph now realized that what he'd taken for an afghan in his mother's lap was actually a mat of bloody eggs in the lap of the Crimson King. It was leaning toward him over this throbbing blanket, its thick lips quivering in a parody of concern.
"Something wrong, Ralphie? Where does it hurt? Tell mother."
"You're not my mother."
"No, I be the queenfish. I be loud and I be proud. I got the walk and I got the talk. Actually, I can be whatever I want. You may not know it, but shape-changing is a time-honored custom in Derry."
"Do you know the green man Lois saw?"
"Of course. I know all the neighborhood folks."
But Ralph sensed momentary puzzlement on that scaly face. The heat along his forearm cranked up another notch, and Ralph had a sudden realization. If Lois were here now, she would hardly be able to see him. The queenfish was putting out a pulsing, ever-brightening glow, and it was gradually surrounding him. The glow was red instead of black,
but it was still a death bag. And now he knew what it was like to be on the inside, caught in a web woven from your sickest fears and most traumatic experiences. There was no way to retreat from it, and no way to cut through it, as he had cut through the death bag which had surrounded Ed's wedding ring. If I'm going to escape, Ralph thought, I'm going to have to do it by running forward so hard and fast, I rip right out the other side. The earring was still in his hand. Now he shifted it so that the naked prong at the back was sticking out between the two fingers a catfish had tried to swallow 63 years ago. Then he said a brief prayer, not to God, but to Lois's green man. The catfish leaned farther forward, a cartoon leer spreading across its noseless face. The teeth inside that flabby grin looked longer and sharper now. Ralph saw drops of colorless fluid beading the ends of the whiskers and thought, poison. Spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair. Man, I'm so scared. Scared to fucking death. Lois, screaming far away, hurry, Ralph, you have to hurry. A little boy was screaming from somewhere a lot closer, screaming and waving his right hand, waving the fish clinging to the fingers buried inside the gullet of a pregnant monster that would not let go. The catfish leaned closer yet. The dress it wore rustled. Ralph could smell his mother's perfume, St. Helena, mixed obscenely with a fishy, garbagey aroma of bottom feeder.
I intend a deep nose errand to end in success, Ralph. I intend that the boy your friends told you about should die in his mother's arms, and I want to see it happen. I've worked very hard here in Derry, and I don't feel that's too much to ask. But it means I have to finish with you right now.
Ralph took a step deeper into the thing's garbagey stink, and now he began to see a shape behind the shape of Mother, behind the shape of the queenfish. He began to see a bright man, a red man with cold eyes and a merciless mouth. This man resembled the Christ he had seen only moments ago, but not the one which had really hung in his mother's kitchen corner. An expression of surprise came into the lidless black eyes of the queenfish, and into the cold eyes of the red man beneath.
What do you think you're doing? Get away from me! Do you want to spend the rest of your life in a wheelchair?
I can think of worse things, pal. My days of playing first base are pretty definitely over.
The voice rose, becoming the voice of his mother when she was angry.
Pay attention to me, boy! Pay attention and mind me!
For a moment, the old commands, given in a voice so eerily like his mother's, made him hesitate. Then he came on again. The queenfish shrank back in the rocker, its tail flipping up and down below the hem of the old house dress.
Just what do you think you're doing?
I don't know. Maybe I just want to give your whiskers a tug. See for myself if they're real.
And exerting all of his willpower to keep from shrieking and fleeing, he reached out with his right hand. Lois's earring felt like a small, warm pebble closed within his fist. Lois herself seemed very close, and Ralph decided that wasn't surprising, considering how much of her aura he'd taken on. Perhaps she was even a part of him now. The feeling of her presence was deeply comforting.
No, you don't dare. You'll be paralyzed.
Catfish aren't poisonous. That was the story of a 10-year-old boy who might have been even more scared than I was.
Ralph reached for the whiskers with a hand concealing the metal thorn, and the massive scaly head flinched away, as some part of him had known it would. It began to ripple and change, and its fearful red aura began to seep through. If sickness and pain had a color, Ralph thought, that would be it. And before the change could go any further, before that man he could now see, tall and coldly handsome, with his blonde hair and glaring red eyes, could step through the shimmer of the illusion it had cast, Ralph drove the sharp point of the earring into one black and bulging fisheye. It made a terrible buzzing sound, like a cicada, Ralph thought, and tried to draw back. Its rapidly flipping tail produced a sound like a fan with a piece of paper caught in the blades. It slid down in the rocker, which was now changing into something that looked like a throne carved from dull orange rock. And then the tail was gone. The queenfish was gone. And it was the Crimson King sitting there, his handsome face twisted into a snarl of pain and amazement. One of his eyes glared as red as the eye of a lynx in firelight. The other was filled with a fierce, splintered glow of diamonds. Ralph reached into the blanket of eggs with his left hand, ripped it away, and saw nothing but blackness on the other side of the abortion, the other side of the death bag, the way out.
"You were warned, you short-time son of a bitch! You think you can pull my whiskers? Well, let's see, shall we? Let's just see!"
The Crimson King leaned forward again on its throne, its mouth yawning, its remaining eye blazing with red light. Ralph fought the urge to yank his now empty right hand away. Instead, he pistoned it forward toward the mouth of the Crimson King, which yawned wide to engulf it, as that long-ago catfish had done that day in the Barrens. Things, not flesh, first squirmed and jostled against his hand, then began to bite like horseflies. At the same time, Ralph felt real teeth, no, fangs, sink into his arm. In a moment, two at the most, the Crimson King would bite through his wrist and swallow his hand whole. Ralph closed his eyes and was at once able to find that pattern of thought and concentration which allowed movement between the levels. His pain and his fear were no bar to that. Only this time his purpose was not to move, but to trigger. Clotho and Lachesis had planted a booby trap inside his arm, and the time had come to set it off. Ralph felt that sensation of blink inside his head. The scar on his arm immediately went white-hot and critical. That heat didn't burn Ralph, but flew out from him in an expanding ripple of energy. He was aware of a titanic green flash, so bright that for one moment it was as if the Emerald City of Oz had exploded all around him. Something or someone was screaming. That high, jagged sound would have driven him mad if it had gone on for long, but it didn't. It was followed by a vast, hollow bang that made Ralph think of the time he had lit an M-80 firecracker and tossed it into a steel culvert. A sudden rush of force blew past him, in a fan of wind and fading green light. He caught a strange, skewed glimpse of the Crimson King, no longer handsome and no longer young, but ancient and twisted, and less human than the strangest creature to ever flop or hop its way along the short-time level of existence. Then something above them opened, revealing darkness shot through with conflicting swirls and rays of color. The wind seemed to blow the Crimson King up toward it, like a leaf in a chimney flue. The colors began to brighten, and Ralph turned his face away, raising one hand to shield his eyes. He understood that a conduit had opened between the level where he was and the unimaginable level stacked above it. He also understood that if he looked for long into that brightening glow, those deadlights, swirling colors, then death would not be the worst thing that could happen to him, but the best. He did not just squeeze his eyes shut, he squeezed his mind shut. A moment later, everything was gone. The creature which had identified itself to Ed as the Crimson King, the kitchen in the old house on Richmond Street, his mother's rocking chair. Ralph was kneeling on thin air, about 6 feet to the right of the Cherokee's nose, his hands upraised as an off-beaten child might raise his hands before the approach of a cruel parent. And when he looked between his knees, he saw the Civic Center and the adjacent parking lot directly below him. At first he thought his eyes were being fooled by an optical illusion, because the arc sodiums in the parking lot seemed to be spreading apart. They almost looked like a crowd of very tall, very skinny people, which is starting to break up because the excitement, whatever it was, is over. And the lot itself seemed to be, well, expanding. Not expanding, but getting closer, Ralph thought coldly. He's going down. He started his kamikaze run. For a moment, Ralph was frozen in place, enchanted by the simple wonder of his position. He'd become a mythical in-between creature, clearly no god. No god could be as tired and terrified as he was right now, but clearly no such earthbound creature as a man, either. This was what it was really like to fly, to see the earth from above, with no border around it. This... Ralph! Her scream was like a shotgun fired beside his ear. Ralph flinched from it, and the moment his gaze left the hypnotic sight of the ground swelling up toward him, he was able to move. He rose to his feet and walked back to the plane. He did this as easily and normally as a man walking down a hallway in his own home. No wind buffeted his face or blew his hair back from his brow, and when his left shoulder passed through the Cherokee's propeller, the whirling blade harmed him no more than it would have harmed smoke. For a moment he saw Ed's pallid, handsome face, the face of the highwayman who'd come riding up to the old inn door in the poem which had always made Carolyn cry, and his previous feeling of mingled pity and regret was replaced by anger. It was difficult to become really infuriated with Ed. He was, after all, just another chess piece being moved across the board. And yet the building he had aimed his airplane at was full of real people. Innocent people. Ralph saw something balky, childish, and willful about the dopey expression of disassociation on Ed's face. And as he passed through the thin skin of the cockpit wall, Ralph thought, I think that on some level, Ed... You knew the devil had come in. I think you might even have been able to put him out again. Didn't Mr. C. and Mr. L. say there's always a choice? If there is, you have to own a piece of this, goddamn you. For a moment, Ralph's head poked through the ceiling, as it had done before, and he knelt again. Now the Civic Center filled the entire windshield of the plane, and he understood that it was too late to stop Ed from doing something. He had pulled the doorbell free of the tape. He was holding it in his hand. Ralph reached into his pocket and gripped the remaining earring, once again holding it between his fingers with the prongs sticking out. He curled his other hand into a tube around the wires running between the cardboard carton and the doorbell. Then he closed his eyes and concentrated, creating that flexing sensation in the middle of his head again. There was a sudden, hollow, fluttery sensation in his stomach, and he had time to think, Whoa, this is the express elevator. Then he was down on the short-time level, where there were no gods or devils, no bald doctors with magic scissors and scalpels, no auras. Down where passing through walls and walking away from plane crashes was an impossibility. Down on the short-time level where he could be seen... And Ed, Ralph realized, was doing just that. Ralph? It was the drugged voice of a man just waking from his life's soundest sleep. Ralph Roberts? What are you doing here? Oh, I was in the neighborhood and I thought I'd drop in, Ralph said. Drag up a rock, so to speak. And with that he closed his curled hand into a fist and tore the wires out of the box. No! Ed shrieked. Oh, no, don't! You'll spoil everything! Yes, indeed, Ralph thought, then reached over Ed's lap to grab the Cherokee's control wheel. The Civic Center was now no more than 1,200 feet below them, perhaps less. Ralph still didn't know for sure what was in the box strapped to the co-pilot's chair, but he had an idea it was probably the plastique stuff the terrorists always used in the martial arts movies starring Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal. It was supposed to be fairly stable, not like the nitro in Clouseau's Wages of Fear, certainly. But this was hardly the time to put his trust in the gospel of movie land. And even a stable explosive might go off without a detonator when dropped from a height of almost 2 miles. He jammed the control wheel as far over to the left as he could. Below them, the Civic Center began to wheel sickeningly around, as if it had been mounted on the spindle of a gigantic top. No, you bastard! Ed yelled, and something that felt like the head of a small hammer struck Ralph in the side, almost paralyzing him with pain and making it all but impossible to breathe. His hand slid off the control wheel as Ed hammered him again, this time in the armpit. Ed seized the wheel and yanked it savagely back over. The Civic Center, which had begun to slip toward the side of the windshield, began to rotate back toward dead center. Ralph clawed at the wheel. Ed placed the heel of his hand on Ralph's forehead and shoved him backward.
Why couldn't you stay out of it?
He snarled.
Why did you have to meddle?
His teeth were bared. His lips pulled back in a jealous snarl. Ralph's appearance in the cockpit should have incapacitated him with shock, but hadn't. Of course not. He's nuts, Ralph thought, and suddenly raised his interior voice in a panicked yell.
Clotho! Lachesis, for Christ's sake, help me!
Nothing. It didn't feel as if his shout were going anywhere. And why would it? He was back down on the short-time level, and that meant he was on his own. The Civic Center was only 800 or 900 feet below them now. Ralph could see every brick, every window, every person standing outside. He could almost even tell which ones were carrying signs. They were looking up, trying to figure out what this crazy plane was doing. Ralph couldn't see the fear on their faces, not yet. But in another 3 or 4 seconds, he launched himself at Ed again, ignoring the throb in his left side and driving his right fist forward, using his thumb to ride the prong of the earring out beyond his fingers as far as possible. The old earring gag had worked on the Crimson King, but Ralph had been higher then, and he'd had the element of surprise more firmly in hand. He went for the eye this time, too, but Ed snapped his head away at the last moment. The prong drove into the side of his face just above the cheekbone. Ed swatted at it as if it were a gnat, holding on tightly to the control wheel with his left hand as he did it. Ralph went for the wheel again. Ed lashed out at him. His fist connected above Ralph's left eye, driving him backward. A single loud tone, pure and silvery, filled Ralph's ears. It was as if there were a large tuning fork somewhere in between them, and someone had struck it. The world went as gray and grainy as a newsprint photograph.
Ralph! Hurry!
It was Lois, and now she was in terror. He knew why. Time had all but run out. He had maybe 10 seconds, 20 at most. He lunged forward again, this time not at Ed, but at the picture of Helen and Nat that was taped above the altimeter. He snatched it, held it up, and then crumpled it between his fingers. He didn't know exactly what reaction he'd hoped for, but the one he got exceeded his wildest hopes.
"Give them back!"
Ed screamed. He forgot about the control wheel and groped for the picture instead. As he did, Ralph again saw the man he had glimpsed on the day Ed had beaten Helen. A man who was desperately unhappy and afraid of the forces which had been set loose within him. There were tears not just in his eyes, but running down his cheeks. And Ralph thought confusedly, has he been crying all along?
Give them back!
He bawled again. But Ralph was no longer sure he was the subject of that cry. He thought his former neighbor might be addressing the being which had stepped into his life, looked around itself to make sure it would do, and then simply taken it over. Lois's earring glittered in Ed's cheek like a barbaric funerary ornament.
Give them back! They're mine!
Ralph held the crumpled photograph just beyond the reach of Ed's waving hands. Ed lunged. The seatbelt bit into his gut, and Ralph punched him in the throat as hard as he could, feeling an indescribable mixture of satisfaction and revulsion as the blow landed on the hard, gristly protuberance of Ed's Adam's apple. Ed fell back against the cockpit wall, eyes bulging with pain and dismay and bewilderment, hands going to his throat. A thick, gagging noise came from somewhere deep inside him. It sounded like some heavy piece of machinery in the process of stripping its gears. Ralph shoved himself forward over Ed's lap and saw the Civic Center now leaping up toward the airplane. He turned the wheel all the way to the left again, and below him, directly below him, the Civic Center again began to rotate toward the side of the Cherokee's soon-to-be-defunct windshield. But it moved with agonizing slowness. Ralph realized he could smell something in the cockpit, some faint aroma both sweet and familiar. Before he could think what it might be, he saw something that distracted him completely. It was the Hoodsy ice cream wagon that sometimes cruised along Harris Avenue, tinkling its cheery little bell. My God, Ralph thought, more in awe than in fear. I think I'm going to wind up in the deep freeze, along with the creamsicles and Hoodsy rockets. That sweet smell was stronger, and his hands suddenly seized his shoulders. Ralph realized it was Lois Chass's perfume.
"Come up!" she screamed. "Ralph, you dummy! You have to..."
He didn't think about it. He just did it. The thing in his mind clenched, the blink happened, and he heard the rest of what she had to say in that eerie, penetrating way that was more thought than speech.
"Come up! Push with your feet!"
Too late, he thought. But he did as she said, nevertheless, planting his feet against the base of the radically canted instrument panel and shoving as hard as he could. He felt Lois rising up through the column of existence with him as the Cherokee shot through the last 100 feet between it and the ground. And as they zoomed upward, he felt a sudden blast of Lois power wrap itself around him and yank him backward like a bungee cord. There was a brief, nauseating sensation of flying in two directions at the same time. Ralph caught a final glimpse of Ed Deepnose slumped against the side wall of the cockpit. But in a very real sense, he did not see him at all. The thunderstruck yellow-gray aura was gone. Ed was also gone, buried in a death bag as black as midnight in hell. Then he and Lois were falling as well as flying. Just before the explosion came, Susan Day, standing in a hot white spotlight at the front of the Civic Center, and now living through the last few seconds of her fabulous, provocative life, was saying, "I haven't come to Derry to heal you, hector you, or to incite you, but to mourn with you. This is a situation which has passed far beyond political considerations. There's no right in violence, nor refuge in self-righteousness. I am here to ask that you put your positions and your rhetoric aside and help each other find a way to help each other. To turn away from the attractions of..." The high windows lining the south side of the auditorium suddenly lit up with a brilliant white glare and then blew inward. The Cherokee missed the Hoodsy wagon, but that didn't save it. The plane took one final half turn in the air and then screwed itself into the parking lot, about 25 feet from the fence where, earlier that day, Lois had paused to yank up her troublesome half-slip. The wings snapped off. The cockpit made a quick and violent journey back through the passenger section. The fuselage blew out with the fury of a bottle of champagne in a microwave oven. Glass flew. The tail bent over the Cherokee's body like the stinger of a dying scorpion, and impaled itself in the roof of a Dodge van with the words, "Protect Women's Right to Choose," stenciled on the side. There was a bright and bitter crunch clang that sounded like a dropped pile of scrap iron. "Holy shit," one of the cops posted on the edge of the parking lot began. And then the C4 inside the cardboard box flew free like a big gray glob of phlegm and struck the remains of the instrument panel, where several hot wires rammed into it like hypo needles. The plastique exploded with an ear-crunching thud, flash-frying the Bassey Park racetrack and turning the parking lot into a hurricane of white light and shrapnel. John Lydecker, who'd been standing under the Civic Center's cement canopy and talking to a state cop, was thrown through one of the open doors and all the way across the lobby. He struck the far wall and fell unconscious into the shattered glass from the harness racing trophy case. At that, he was luckier than the man with whom he'd been standing. The state cop was thrown into the post between two of the open doors and chopped in half. The ranks of cars actually shielded the Civic Center from the worst of the hammering concussive blow, but that blessing would only be counted later. Inside, over 2,000 people at first sat stunned, unsure of what they should do, and even more unsure of what most of them had just seen. America's most famous feminist decapitated by a jagged chunk of flying glass. Her head went flying into the sixth row like some strange white bowling ball with a blonde wig pasted on it. They didn't erupt into panic until the lights went out. 71 people were killed in the trampling, panicked rush to the exits. And the next day, as Derry News would trumpet the event with a 48-point scare headline, calling it a terrible tragedy. Ralph Roberts could have told them that, all things considered, they had gotten off lucky. Very lucky indeed. Halfway up the north balcony, a woman named Sonia Danville, a woman with the bruises of the last beating any man would ever give her, still fading from her face, sat with her arms around the shoulders of her son, Patrick. Patrick's McDonald's poster, showing Ronald and Mayor McCheese and the Hamburglar dancing the boot scootin' boogie just outside a drive-through window, was on his lap. But he had hardly done more than color the golden arches before turning the poster over to the blank side. It wasn't that he had lost interest. It was just that he'd had an idea for a picture of his own, and it had come, as such ideas often did to him, with the force of a compulsion. He had spent most of the day thinking about what had happened in the cellar at High Ridge. The smoke, the heat, the frightened women, and the two angels that had come to save him. But his splendid idea banished these disturbing thoughts, and he fell to work with silent enthusiasm. Soon Patrick felt almost as if he were living in the world he was drawing with his Crayolas. He was an amazingly competent artist already, only 4 years old or not. My little genius, Sonia sometimes called him. And his picture was much better than the color-it-in poster on the other side of the sheet. What he had managed before the lights went out was work a gifted first-year art student might have been proud of. In the middle of the poster sheet, a tower of dark, soot-colored stone rose into a blue sky dotted with fat white clouds. Surrounding it was a field of roses, so red they almost seemed to clamor aloud. Standing off to one side was a man dressed in faded blue jeans. A pair of gun belts crossed his flat middle. A holster hung below each hip. At the very top of the tower, a man in a red robe was looking down at the gunfighter with an expression of mingled hate and fear. His hands, which were curled over the parapet, also appeared to be red. Sonia had been mesmerized by the presence of Susan Day, who was sitting behind the lectern and listening to her introduction. But she had happened to glance down at her son's picture just before the introduction ended. She'd known for 2 years that Patrick was what the child psychologists called a prodigy, and she sometimes told herself she had gotten used to his sophisticated drawings and the Play-Doh sculptures he called the Clay family. Perhaps she even had, to some degree. But this particular picture gave her a strange, deep chill that she could not entirely dismiss as emotional fallout from her long and stressful day. "Who's that?" she asked, tapping the tiny figure peering jealously down from the top of the dark tower.
"Him's the Red King," Patrick said.
"Oh, the Red King, I see.
And who's this man with the guns?"
As he opened his mouth to answer, Roberta Harper, the woman at the podium, lifted her left arm, there was a black mourning band on it, toward the woman sitting behind her. "My friends, Miss Susan Day," she cried, and Patrick Danville's answer to his mother's second question was lost in the rising storm of applause.
"Him's name is Roland, Mama. I dream about him sometimes. Him's a king, too."
Now the two of them sat in the dark with their ears ringing. And two thoughts ran through Sonia's mind like rats chasing each other on a treadmill. "Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day..."
"Mommy, you're scrunching my picture," Patrick said.
He sounded a little out of breath, and Sonia realized she must be scrunching him, too. She eased up a little. A tattered skein of screams, shouts, and babbled questions came from a dark pit below them, where the people rich enough to pony up $15 donations had been seated in folding chairs. A rough howl of pain cut through this babble, making Sonia jump in her seat. The thudding crump which had followed the initial explosion had pressed in painfully on their ears and shaken the building. The blasts, which were still going on, cars exploding like firecrackers in the parking lot, sounded small and inconsequential in comparison. But Sonia felt Patrick flinch against her with each one. "Stay calm, Pat," she told him. "Something bad's happened, but I think it happened outside." Because her eyes had been drawn to the bright glare in the windows, Sonia had mercifully missed seeing her heroine's head leaving her shoulders. But she knew that somehow lightning had struck in the same place. Shouldn't have brought him. Shouldn't have brought him. And that at least some of the people below them were panicking. If she panicked, she and young Rembrandt were going to be in serious trouble. "But I'm not going to. I didn't get out of that death box this morning just to panic now. I'll be goddamned if I will." She reached down and took one of Patrick's hands, the one that wasn't clutching his picture. It was very cold. "Do you think the angels will come to save us again, Mama?" he asked in a voice that quivered slightly. "Nah," she said. "I think this time we'd better do it ourselves. But we can do that. I mean, we're all right now, aren't we?" "Yes," he said, but then slumped against her. She had a terrible moment when she was sure he had fainted and she'd have to carry him from the Civic Center in her arms. But then he straightened up again.
"My books was on the floor," he said. I didn't want to leave without my books, especially the one about the boy who can't take off his hat. Are we leaving, Mama?"
"Yes, as soon as people stop running around. There'll be lights in the halls, ones that run on batteries, even though the ones in here are out. When I say we're going to get up and walk up the steps to the door. I'm not going to carry you, but I'm going to walk right behind you with both my hands on your shoulders. Do you understand, Pat?"
"Yes, Mama."
No questions, no blubbering, just his books thrust into her hands for safekeeping. He held on to the picture himself. She gave him a quick hug and kissed his cheek. They waited in their seats 5 minutes by her slow count to 300. She sensed that most of their immediate neighbors were gone before she got to 150, but she made herself wait. She could now see a little, enough for her to believe that something was burning fiercely outside, but on the far side of the building. That was very lucky. She could hear the warbled wail of approaching police cars, ambulances, and fire trucks. Sonia got to her feet. "Come on. Keep right in front of me." Pat Danville stepped into the aisle with his mother's hands pressed firmly down on his shoulders. He led her up the stairs toward the dim yellow lights which marked the north balcony corridor, stopping only once as the dark shape of a running man hurtled toward them. His mother's hands tightened on his shoulders as she yanked him aside.
"Goddamn right to lifers!" the running man cried. "Fucking self-righteous turds! I'd like to kill them all!"
Then he was gone, and Pat began walking up the stairs again. She felt a calmness in him now, a centered lack of fear that touched her heart with love, and with some queer darkness as well. He was so different, her son, so special. But the world did not love people like that. The world tried to root them out like tares from a garden. They emerged at last into the corridor. A few deeply shocked people wandered back and forth, eyes dazed and mouths agape, like zombies in a horror movie. Sonia hardly glanced at them, just got Pat moving toward the stairs. 3 minutes later, they exited into the fire-shot night, perfectly unscathed, and upon all the levels of the universe, matters both random and purposeful resumed their ordained courses. Worlds which had trembled for a moment in their orbits now steadied. And in one of those worlds, in a desert that was the apotheosis of all deserts, a man named Roland turned over in his bedroll and slept easily once again beneath the alien constellations. Across town in Strawford Park, the door of the Porto San marked Men blew open. Lois Chass and Ralph Roberts came flying out backward in a haze of smoke, clutching each other. From within came the sound of the Cherokee hitting and then the plastique exploding. There was a flash of white light, and the toilet's blue walls bulged outward, as if some giant had hammered them with his fists. A second later, they heard the explosion all over again. This time it came rolling across the open air. The second version was fainter, but somehow more real. Lois's feet stuttered, and she thumped to the grass of the lower hillside with a cry, which was partly relief. Ralph landed beside her, then pushed himself up to a sitting position. He stared unbelievingly at the Civic Center, where a fist of fire was now clenched on the horizon. A purple lump, the size of a doorknob, was rising on his forehead, where Ed had hit him. His left side still throbbed, but he thought maybe the ribs in there were only sprung, not broken. "Lois, are you all right?" She looked at him uncomprehendingly for a moment, then began to feel at her face and neck and shoulders. There was something so perfectly, sweetly our Lois about this examination that Ralph laughed. He couldn't help it. Lois smiled tentatively back at him. "I think I'm fine. In fact, I'm quite sure I am." "What were you doing there? You could have been killed." Lois, appearing somewhat rejuvenated, Ralph guessed that the handy wino had had something to do with that, looked him in the eye. "I may be old-fashioned, Ralph, but if you think I'm going to spend the next 20 years or so fainting and fluttering like the heroine's best friend in those Regency romances my friend Minna's always reading, you better pick another woman to chum around with." He gaped for a moment, then pulled her to her feet and hugged her. Lois hugged back. She was incredibly warm, incredibly there. Ralph reflected for a moment on the similarities between loneliness and insomnia, how they were both insidious, cumulative, and divisive, the friends of despair and the enemies of love. And then he pushed those thoughts aside and kissed her. Clotho and Lachesis, who had been standing at the top of the hill and looking as anxious as workmen who have wagered their Christmas bonuses on a prize-fight underdog, now rushed down to where Ralph and Lois stood with their foreheads once more pressed together, looking into each other's eyes like love-struck teenagers. From the far side of the barrens, the sound of sirens rose like voices heard in uneasy dreams. The pillar of fire which marked the grave of Ed Deepnose's obsession was now too bright to look at without squinting. Ralph could hear the faint sound of cars exploding, and he thought of his car, sitting abandoned somewhere out in the Willywags. He decided that was okay. He was too old to drive.
Clotho,
are you both all right?
Ralph, we're fine. Lois reeled me in. She saved my life. Lachesis.
Yes, we saw her go in. It was very brave.
Also very perplexing, right, Mr. L? Ralph thought. You saw it and you admire it. But I don't think you have any idea of how or why she could bring herself to do it. I think that, to you and your friend, the concept of rescue must seem almost as foreign as the idea of love. For the first time, Ralph felt a kind of pity for the little bald doctors, and understood the central irony of their lives. They were aware that the short-timers whose existences they had been sent to prune lived powerful inner lives, but they did not in the least comprehend the reality of those lives, the emotions which drove them, or the actions, sometimes noble, sometimes foolish, which resulted. Mr. C. and Mr. L. had studied their short-time charges as certain rich but timid Englishmen had studied the maps brought back by the explorers of the Victorian age. Explorers who had in many cases been funded by these same rich but timid men. With their clipped nails and soft fingers, the philanthropists had traced paper rivers upon which they would never ride and paper jungles through which they would never safari. They lived in fearful perplexity and passed it off as imagination. Clotho and Lachesis had drafted them, and had used them with a certain crude effectiveness, but they understood neither the joy of risk nor the sorrow of loss. The best they had been able to manage in the way of emotion was a nagging fear that Ralph and Lois would try to take on the Crimson King's pet research chemist directly, and be swatted like elderly flies for their pains. The little bald doctors lived long lives, but Ralph suspected that, brilliant dragonfly auras notwithstanding, they were gray lives. He looked at their unlined, oddly childish faces
from the safe haven of Lois's arms and remembered how terrified of them he had been when he had first seen them coming out of May Locker's house in the early hours of the morning. Terror, he had since discovered, could not survive mere acquaintanceship, let alone knowledge, and now he had some of both. Clotho and Lachesis returned his gaze with an uneasiness Ralph found he had absolutely no urge to allay. It seemed very right to him, somehow, that they should feel the way they were feeling. Ralph,
yes, she's very brave, and I love her very much, and I think we'll make each other very happy until...
He broke off, and Lois stirred in his arms. He realized, with a mixture of amusement and relief, that she'd been half asleep.
Until what, Ralph? Until you name it. I guess that there's always an until when you're a short-timer, and maybe that's okay.
Lachesis.
Well, I guess this is goodbye.
Ralph grinned in spite of himself, reminded of the Lone Ranger radio program, where almost every episode had ended with some version of that line. He reached out toward Lachesis and was sourly amused to see the little man recoil from him.
Ralph. Wait a minute. Let's not be so hasty, fellas.
Clotho, with a tinge of apprehension.
Is something wrong?
I don't think so. But after getting popped in the head, popped in the ribs, and then damn near roasted alive, I think I have a right to make sure that it's really over. Is it? Is your boy safe?
Clotho, smiling and clearly relieved.
Yes. Can't you feel it? 18 years from now, just before his death, the boy is going to save the lives of 2 men who would otherwise die. And one of those men must not die if the balance between the random and the purpose is to be maintained.
Lois, never mind all that. I just want to know if we can go back to being regular short-timers again.
Lachesis.
Not only can, Lois, but must. If you and Ralph were to stay up here much longer, you wouldn't be able to go back down.
Ralph felt Lois press more tightly against him.
I wouldn't like that.
Clotho and Lachesis turned toward each other and a subtle, perplexed glance. How could anybody not like it up here? Their eyes asked. Passed between them before they turned back to Ralph and Lois.
Lachesis.
We really must be going. I'm sorry, but...
Ralph. Hold on, neighbors. You're not going anywhere yet.
They looked at him apprehensively, while Ralph slowly pushed up the sleeve of his sweater. The cuff was now stiff with some fluid, perhaps catfish ichor, that he found he did not want to think about, and showed them the white, knotted line of scar on his forearm.
Put away the constipated looks, guys. I just want to remind you that you gave me your word. Don't forget that part of it.
Clotho, with obvious relief.
You can depend on it, Ralph. What was your weapon is now our bond. The promise will not be forgotten.
Ralph was beginning to believe it really was over, and crazy as it seemed, part of him regretted it. Now it was real life, life as it went on the floors below this level, that seemed almost like a mirage, and he understood what Lachesis had meant when he told him that they would never be able to return to their normal lives if they stayed up here much longer.
Lachesis.
We really must go. Fare you well, Ralph and Lois. We will never forget the service you have rendered us.
Ralph. Did we ever have a choice? Did we really?
Lachesis, very softly.
We told you so, didn't we? For short-timers, there's always choice. We find that frightening, but we also find it beautiful.
Ralph. Say, do you fellows ever shake hands?
Clotho and Lachesis glanced at each other, startled, and Ralph sensed some quick dialogue flashing between them in a kind of telepathic shorthand. When they looked back at Ralph, they wore identical nervous smiles, the smiles of teenage boys who have decided that if they can't find enough courage to ride the big roller coaster at the amusement park this summer, they will never truly be men.
Clotho, we have observed this custom many times, of course, but... No, we have never shaken hands.
Ralph looked at Lois and saw she was smiling, but he thought he saw a shimmer of tears in her eyes as well. He offered his hand to Lachesis first, because Mr. L seemed marginally less jumpy than his colleague.
"Put her there, Mr. L."
Lachesis looked at Ralph's hand for so long that Ralph began to think he wasn't going to be able to actually do it, although he clearly wanted to. Then, timidly, he put out his own small hand and allowed Ralph's larger one to close over it. There was a tingling vibration in Ralph's flesh as their auras first mingled, then merged. And in that merging, he saw a series of swift, beautiful silver patterns. They reminded him of the Japanese characters on Ed's scarf. He pumped Lachesis's hand twice, slowly and formally, then released it. Lachesis's look of apprehension had been replaced by a large, goony smile. He turned to his partner.
"His force is almost completely unguarded during this ceremony. I felt it. It's quite wonderful."
Clotho inched his own hand out to meet Ralph's, and in the instant before they touched, Mr. C closed his eyes like a man expecting a painful injection. Lachesis, meanwhile, was shaking hands with Lois and grinning like a vaudeville hoofer taking an encore. Clotho appeared to steel himself, then seized Ralph's hand. He flagged it once firmly. Ralph grinned.
"Take her easy, Mr. C."
Clotho withdrew his hand. He seemed to be searching for the proper response.
"Thank you, Ralph. I will take her any way I can get her. Correct?"
Ralph burst out laughing. Clotho, now turning to shake hands with Lois, gave him a puzzled smile, and Ralph clapped him on the back.
"You got it right, Mr. C. Absolutely right."
He slipped his arm around Lois and gave the little bald doctors a final curious look.
"I'll be seeing you fellas again, won't I?"
Clotho.
"Yes, Ralph."
Ralph. "Well, that's fine. About 70 years from now would be good for me. Why don't you boys just put it down on your calendar?"
They responded with the smiles of politicians, which didn't surprise him much. Ralph gave them a little bow, then put his arms around Lois's shoulders and watched as Mr. C and Mr. L walked slowly down the hill. Lachesis opened the door of the slightly warped portezan marked Men. Clotho stood in the open doorway of Women. Lachesis smiled and waved. Clotho lifted the long-bladed scissors in a queer sort of salute. Ralph and Lois waved back. The bald doctor stepped inside and closed the doors. Lois wiped her streaming eyes and turned to Ralph.
"Is that it?"
"It is, isn't it?" Ralph nodded.
"What do we do now?"
He held out his arm.
"May I see you home, madam?"
Smiling, she clasped his forearm just below the elbow.
"Thank you, sir. You may."
They left Strawford Park that way, returning to the short-time level as they came out on Harris Avenue, slipping back down to their normal place in the scheme of things, with no fuss or bother, without, in fact, even being aware they were doing it until it was done. Derry groaned with panic and sweated with excitement. Sirens wailed, people shouted from second-story windows to friends on the sidewalks below, and on every street corner people had clustered to watch the fire on the other side of the valley. Ralph and Lois paid no attention to the tumult and hurrah. They walked slowly up Mile Hill, increasingly aware of their exhaustion. It seemed to come piling into them like softly thrown bags of sand. The pool of white light marking the Red Apple Store's parking lot seemed an impossible distance away, although Ralph knew it was only 3 blocks, and short ones at that. To make matters worse, the temperature had dropped a good 15 degrees since that morning. The wind was blowing hard, and neither of them was dressed for the weather. Ralph suspected this might be the leading edge of autumn's first big gale, and that in Derry, Indian summer was over. Fay Chapin, Don Veazey, and Stan Everly came hurrying down the hill toward them, obviously bound for Strawford Park. The field glass's old door, sometimes used to watch planes taxi, land, and take off, were bouncing around Fay's neck. With Don, who was balding and heavyset, in the middle, their resemblance to a more famous trio was inescapable. The Three Stooges of the Apocalypse, Ralph thought, and grinned.
"Ralph,"
Fay exclaimed. He was breathing fast, almost panting. The wind blew his hair into his eyes, and he raked it back impatiently.
Goddamn Civic Center blew up. Someone bombed it from a light plane. We heard there's 1,000 people dead.
I heard about the same, Ralph agreed gravely. In fact, Lois and I have just been down at the park having a look. You can see straight across the valley from there, you know.
Christ, I know that. I've lived here all my damn life, haven't I? Where do you think we're going? Come on back with us.
Lois and I were just headed up to her house to see what they've got about it on TV. Maybe we'll join you later.
Okay, we... Jeepers creepers, Ralph. What did you do to your head?
For a moment, Ralph drew a blank. What had he done to his head? And then, in an instant of nightmarish recall, he saw Ed's snarling mouth and mad eyes.
Oh, no, don't!
Ed had screamed at him.
You'll spoil everything!
We were running to get a better look, and Ralph ran into a tree, Lois said. He's lucky not to be in the hospital. Don laughed at that, but in the half-distracted manner of a fellow who has bigger fish to fry. Fay wasn't paying attention to them at all. Stan Eberle was, however, and Stan didn't laugh. He was looking at them with close, puzzled curiosity.
Lois, he said.
What?
Did you know you've got a sneaker tied to your wrist?
She looked down at it. Ralph looked down at it. Then Lois looked up and gave Stan a dazzling, eye-frying smile.
Yes, she said. It's an interesting look, isn't it? Sort of a life-sized charm bracelet.
Yeah, Stan said.
Sure.
But he wasn't looking at the sneaker anymore. Now he was looking at Lois's face. Ralph wondered how in hell they were going to explain how they looked tomorrow, when there were no shadows between the streetlights to hide them.
Come on, Fay cried impatiently. Let's get going.
They hurried off. Stan gave them one last doubtful glance over his shoulder as they went. Ralph listened after them, almost expecting Don Vesey to give out a nyuk, nyuk or two.
Boy, that sounded so dumb, Lois said. But I had to say something, didn't I?
You did fine.
Well, when I open my mouth, something always seems to fall out, she said. It's one of my two great talents, the other being the ability to clean out an entire Whitman sampler during a two-hour TV movie.
She untied Helen's sneaker and looked at it.
She's safe, isn't she?
Yes, Ralph agreed and reached for the sneaker. As he did, he realized he already had something in his left hand. The fingers had been clamped down so long that they were creaky and reluctant to open. When they finally did, he saw the marks of his nails pressed into the flesh of his palm. The first thing he was aware of was that, while his own wedding ring was still in its accustomed place, Ed's was gone. It had seemed a perfect fit, but apparently it had slipped off his finger at some point during the last half an hour, just the same.
Maybe not, a voice whispered,
and Ralph was amused to realize that it wasn't Carolyn's this time. This time the voice in his head belonged to Bill McGovern.
Maybe it just disappeared. You know, poof.
But he didn't think so. He had an idea that Ed's wedding band might have been invested with powers that hadn't necessarily died with Ed. The ring Bilbo Baggins had found and reluctantly given up to his grandson Frodo had had a way of going where it wanted to, and when. Perhaps Ed's ring wasn't all that different. Before he could consider this idea further, Lois traded Helen's sneaker for the thing in his hand, a small, stiff crumple of paper. She smoothed it out and looked at it. Her curiosity slowly changed to solemnity.
I remember this picture, she said. The big one was on the mantel in their living room, in a fancy gold frame. It had pride of place.
Ralph nodded. This must have been the one he carried in his wallet. It was taped to the instrument panel of the plane. Until I took it, he was beating me, and not even breathing hard while he did it. Grabbing his picture was all I could think of to do. When I did, his focus shifted from the Civic Center to them. The last thing I heard him say was, "Give them back! They're mine!" And was he talking to you when he said it?
Ralph stuck the sneaker into his back pocket and shook his head. Nope, don't think so. Helen was at the Civic Center tonight, wasn't she? Yes. Ralph thought of how she had looked out at High Ridge, her pale face and smoke-reddened, watering eyes. If they stop us now, they win, she'd said. Don't you see that? And now he did see. He took the picture from Lois's hand, crumpled it up again, and walked over to the litter basket which stood on the corner of Harris Avenue and Kossuth Lane. We'll get another picture of them sometime, one we can keep on our own mantle, something not quite so formal. This one, though, I don't want it. He tossed the little ball of paper at the litter basket, an easy shot, 2 feet at the most. But the wind picked that moment to gust, and the crumpled photo of Helen and Natalie, which had been taped above the altimeter of Ed's plane, flew away on its cold breath. The two of them watched it whirl up into the sky, almost hypnotized. It was Lois who looked away first. She glanced at Ralph with a trace of a smile curving her lips. Did I hear a backhand proposal of marriage from you? Or am I just tired? She asked. He opened his mouth to reply, and another gust of wind struck them. This one so hard it made them both wince their eyes shut. When he opened his, Lois had already started up the hill again. Anything's possible, Lois, he said. I know that now. 5 minutes later, Lois's key rattled in the lock of her front door. She led Ralph inside and shut it firmly behind them, closing out the windy, contentious night. He followed her into the living room and would have stopped there, but Lois never hesitated. Still holding his hand, not quite pulling him along, but perhaps meaning to do so if he began to lag, she showed him into her bedroom. He looked at her. Lois looked calmly back, and suddenly he felt the blink happen again. He watched her aura bloom around her like a gray rose. It was still diminished, but it was already coming back, re-knitting itself, healing itself. Lois, are you sure this is what you want? Of course it is. You think I was going to give you a pat on the head and send you home after all we've been through? Suddenly she smiled, a wickedly mischievous smile. Besides, Ralph, do you really feel like getting up to Dickens tonight? Tell me the truth. Better still, don't flatter me. He considered it, then laughed and drew her into his arms. Her mouth was sweet and slightly moist, like the skin of a ripe peach. That kiss seemed to tingle through his entire body, but the sensation was most concentrated in his mouth, where it felt almost like an electric shock. When their lips parted, he felt more excited than ever, but he also felt queerly drained. What if I say I do, Lois? What if I say I do want to get up to Dickens? She stood back and looked at him critically, as if trying to decide whether he meant what he said, or if it was just the usual male bluff and brag. At the same time, her hands went to the buttons of her dress. As she began to slip them free, Ralph noticed a wonderful thing. She looked younger again. Not 40 by any stretch of the imagination, but surely no more than 50, and a young 50. It had been the kiss, of course, and the really amusing thing was he didn't think she had the slightest idea that she had added a helping of Ralph to her earlier helping of Wino. And what was wrong with that? She finished her inspection, leaned forward, and kissed his cheek. I think that there'll be plenty of time for getting up to Dickens later, Ralph. Tonight's for sleeping. He supposed she was right. 5 minutes ago, he had been more than willing. He had always loved the act of physical love, and it had been a long time. For now, however, the spark was gone. Ralph didn't regret that in the least. He knew, after all, where it had gone. Okay, Lois, tonight's for sleeping. She went into the bathroom and the shower went on. A few minutes later, Ralph heard her brushing her teeth. It was nice to know she still had them. During the 10 minutes she was gone, he managed to do a certain amount of undressing, although his throbbing ribs made it slow work. He finally succeeded in wriggling McGovern's sweater off and pushing out of his shoes. His shirt came next,
and he was fumbling ineffectually with a buckle of his belt when Lois came out with her hair tied back and her face shining. Ralph was stunned by her beauty and suddenly felt much too big and stupid, not to mention old, for his own good. She was wearing a long rose-colored silk nightgown, and he could smell the lotion she had used on her hands. It was a good smell.
"Let me do that," she said, and had his belt unbuckled before he could say much, one way or the other. There was nothing erotic about it. She moved with the efficiency of a woman who had often helped her husband dress and undress during the last year of his life. "We're down again," he said. "This time I didn't even feel it happening." "I did, while I was in the shower. I was glad, actually. Trying to wash your hair through an aura is very distracting." The wind gusted outside, shaking the house and blowing a long, shivering note across the mouth of a downspout. They looked toward the window, and although he was back down on the short-time level, Ralph was suddenly sure that Lois was sharing his own thought. Atropos was out there somewhere right now, no doubt disappointed by the way things had gone, but by no means crushed. Bloody but unbowed, down but not out. From now on they can call him Old One Ear, Ralph thought and shivered. He imagined Atropos swinging erratically through the scared, excited populace of the city, like a rogue asteroid, peering and hiding, stealing souvenirs and slashing balloon strings, taking solace in his work, in other words. Ralph found it almost impossible to believe that he'd been sitting on top of that creature and slashing at him with his own scalpel not very long ago. "How did I ever find the courage?" he wondered. But he supposed he knew. The diamond earrings the little monster had been wearing had provided most of it. Did Atropos know those earrings had been his biggest mistake? Probably not. In his way, Doc Number 3 had proved even more ignorant of short-time motivations than Clotho and Lachesis. He turned to Lois and grasped her hands. "I lost your earrings again. This time they're gone for good, I think." "I'm sorry." "Don't apologize. They were already lost, remember? And I'm not worried about Harold and Jan anymore, because now I've got a friend to help me when people don't treat me right, or when I just get scared, don't I?" "Yes, you most certainly do." She put her arms around him, hugged him tightly, and kissed him again. Lois had apparently not forgotten a single thing she'd ever learned about kissing, and it seemed to Ralph that she'd learned quite a lot. "Go on and hop in the shower." He started to say that he thought he'd fall asleep the moment he got his head under a stream of warm water, but then she added something which changed his mind in a hurry. "Don't take offense, but there's a funny smell on you, especially on your hands. It's the way my brother Vic used to smell after he'd spent the day cleaning fish." Ralph was in the shower 2 minutes later, and in soap suds up to his elbows. When he came out, Lois was buried beneath two puffy quilts. Only her face showed, and that was visible only from the nose up. Ralph crossed the room quickly, wearing only his undershorts and painfully conscious of his spindly legs and pot belly. He tossed back the covers and slid in quickly, gasping a little as the cool sheets slid along his warm skin. Lois slipped over to his side of the bed at once and put her arms around him. He put his face in her hair and let himself relax against her. It was very good being with Lois under the quilts, while the wind shrieked and gusted outside, sometimes hot enough to rattle the storm windows in their frames. It was, in fact, heaven. "Thank God there's a man in my bed," Lois said sleepily. "Thank God it's me," Ralph replied, and she laughed. "Are your ribs okay? Do you want me to find you an aspirin?" "Nope. I'm sure they'll hurt again in the morning, but right now the hot water seems to have loosened everything up." The subject of what might or might not happen in the morning raised a question in his mind, one that had probably been waiting there all along. "Lois?" "Hmm?" In his mind's eye, Ralph could see himself snapping awake in the dark, deeply tired but not at all sleepy. It was surely one of the world's cruelest paradoxes. As the numbers on the digital clock turned wearily over from 3:47 a.m. to 3:48, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Dark Night of the Soul, when every hour was long enough to build the Great Pyramid of Cheops. "Do you think we'll sleep through?" he asked her. "Yes," she said unhesitatingly. "I think we'll sleep just fine." A moment later, Lois was doing just that. Ralph stayed awake for perhaps 5 minutes longer, holding her in his arms, smelling the wonderful interwoven scents rising from her warm skin, luxuriating in the smooth, sensuous glide of the silk under his hands, marveling at where he was, even more than the events which had brought him here. He was filled with some deep and simple emotion, one he recognized but could not immediately name, perhaps because it had been gone from his life too long. The wind gusted and moaned outside, producing that hollow hooting sound over the top of the drain pipe again, like the world's biggest Nirvana boy blowing over the mouth of the world's biggest pop bottle. And it occurred to Ralph that maybe nothing in life was better than lying deep in a soft bed with a sleeping woman in your arms while the fall wind screamed outside your safe haven. Except there was something better, one thing at least, and that was the feeling of falling asleep, of going gently into that good night, slipping out into the currents of unknowing, the way a canoe slips away from a dock and slides into the current of a wide, slow river on a bright summer day. Of all the things which make up our short-time lives, sleep is surely the best, Ralph thought. The wind gusted again outside, the sound of it now seeming to come from a great distance, and as he felt the tug of that great river take him, he was finally able to identify the emotion he had been feeling ever since Lois had put her arms around him and fallen asleep as easily and as trustingly as a child. It went under many different names. Peace, serenity, fulfillment. But now, as the wind blew and Lois made some dark sound of sleeping contentment far back in her throat, it seemed to Ralph that it was one of those rare things which are known but essentially unnameable. A texture, an aura, perhaps a whole level of being in that column of existence. It was the smooth, russet color of rest. It was the silence which follows the completion of some arduous but necessary task. When the wind gusted again, bringing the sound of distant sirens with it, Ralph didn't hear it. He was asleep. Once he dreamed that he got up to use the bathroom, and he supposed that might not have been a dream. At another time, he dreamed that he and Lois made slow, sweet love, and that might not have been a dream either. If there were other dreams or moments of waking, he did not remember them. And this time, there was no snapping awake at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They slept, sometimes apart, but mostly together, until just past 7 o'clock on Saturday evening, about 22 hours all told. Lois made them breakfast at sunset. Splendidly puffy waffles, bacon, home fries. While she cooked, Ralph tried to flex that muscle buried deep in his mind, to create that sensation of blink. He couldn't do it. When Lois tried, she was also unable, although Ralph could have sworn that just for a moment she flickered, and he could see the stove right through her. "Just as well," she said, bringing their plates to the table. "I suppose," Ralph agreed, but he still felt as he would have if he had lost the ring Carolyn had given him, instead of the one he had taken from Atropos. As if some small but essential object had gone rolling out of his life with a wink and a gleam. Following 2 more nights of sound, unbroken sleep, the auras had begun to fade as well. By the following week, they were gone, and Ralph began to wonder if perhaps the whole thing hadn't been some strange dream. He knew that wasn't so, but it became harder and harder to believe what he did know. There was the scar between the elbow and wrist of his right arm, of course, but he even began to wonder if that wasn't something he had acquired long ago, during those years of his life when there had been no white in his hair, and he had still believed, deep in his heart, that old age was a myth, or a dream, or a thing reserved for people not as special as he was. Epilogue. Winding the Death Watch, 2.
Glancing over my shoulder, I see its shape and so move forward, as someone in the woods at night might hear the sound of approaching feet and stop to listen. Then, instead of silence, he hears some creature trying to be silent. What else can he do but run? Rushing blindly down the path, stumbling, struck in the face by sticks, the other ever closer, yet not really hurrying or out of breath, teasing its kill. Stephen Dobbins, Pursuit. If I had some wings, I'd fly you all around. If I had some money, I'd buy you the goddamn town. If I had the strength, then maybe I could have pulled you through. If I had a lantern, I'd light the way for you. If I had a lantern, I'd light the way for you. Michael McDermott, Lantern. On January 2nd, 1994, Lois Chass became Lois Roberts. Her son, Harold, gave her away. Harold's wife did not attend the ceremony. She was up in Bangor with what Ralph considered a highly suspect case of bronchitis. He kept his suspicions to himself, however, being far from disappointed at Jan Chass's failure to appear. The groom's best man was Detective John Lydecker, who still wore a cast on his right arm, but otherwise showed no signs of the assignment which had nearly killed him. He had spent 4 days in a coma, but Lydecker knew how lucky he was. In addition to the state trooper who had been standing beside him at the time of the explosion, 6 cops had died, 2 of them members of Lydecker's hand-picked team. The bride's maid of honor was her friend Simone Castingay, and at the reception, the first toast was made by a fellow who liked to say he used to be Joe Wise, but was now older and wiser. Trigger Vachon delivered a fractured but heartfelt follow-up, concluding with a wish that these 2 people gonna live to 150 and never know a day of the rheumatiz or constipations. When Ralph and Lois left the reception hall, the hair still full of rice thrown for the most part by Faye Chapin and the rest of the Harris Avenue old crocs, an old man with a book in his hand and a fine cloud of white hair floating around his head came walking up to them. He had a wide smile on his face.
"Congratulations, Ralph," he said. "Congratulations, Lois."
"Thanks, Dor," Ralph said. "We missed you," Lois told him. "Didn't you get your invitation? Faye said he'd give it to you."
"Oh, he gave it to me. Yes, oh yes, he did. But I don't go to those things if they're inside. Too stuffy. Funerals are even worse. Here, this is for you. I didn't wrap it because the arthritis is in my fingers too bad for stuff like that now."
Ralph took it. It was a book of poems called Concurring Beasts. The poet's name, Stephen Dobbins, gave him a funny little chill, but he wasn't quite sure why.
"Thanks," he told Dorrance. "Not as good as some of his later work, but good. Dobbins is very good."
"We'll read them to each other on our honeymoon," Lois said.
"That's a good time to read poetry," Dorrance said. "Maybe the best time. I'm sure you'll be very happy together."
He started off, then looked back.
"You did a great thing. The long-timers are very pleased."
He walked away. Lois looked at Ralph. What was he talking about? Do you know? Ralph shook his head. He didn't, not for sure, although he felt as if he should know. The scar on his arm had begun to tingle as it sometimes did, a feeling which was almost like a deep-seated itch. "Long-timers," she mused. "Maybe he meant us, Ralph. After all, we're hardly spring chickens these days, are we?" "That's probably just what he did mean," Ralph agreed. But he knew better, and her eyes said that, somewhere deep down, so did she. On that same day, and just as Ralph and Lois were saying their I do's, a certain wino with a bright green aura, one who actually did have an uncle in Dexter, although the uncle hadn't seen this ne'er-do-well nephew for 5 years or more, was tramping across Strawford Park,
slitting his eyes against the formidable glare of sun on snow. He was looking for returnable cans and bottles. Enough to buy a pint of whiskey would be great, but a pint of night train wine would do. Not far from the Port-au-Sand marked men, he saw a bright gleam of metal. It was probably just the sun reflecting off a bottle cap, but such things needed to be checked out. It might be a dime, although to the wino it actually seemed to have a goldy sort of gleam. "Holy Judas!" he cried, snatching up the wedding ring which lay mysteriously on top of the snow. It was a broad band, almost certainly gold. He tilted it to read the engraving on the inside. H.D. ED 8587. A pint? Hell no! This little baby was going to secure him a quart. Several quarts. Possibly a week's worth of quarts. Hurrying across the intersection of Witcham and Jackson, the one where Ralph Roberts had once almost fainted, the wino never saw the approaching Green Line bus. The driver saw him and put on his brakes, but the bus struck a patch of ice. The wino never knew what hit him. At one moment he was debating between Old Crow and Old Granddad. At the next he had passed into the darkness which awaits us all. The ring rolled down the gutter and disappeared into a sewer grate, and there it remained for a long, long time, but not forever. In Derry, things that disappear into the sewer system have a way, an often unpleasant one, of turning up. Ralph and Lois didn't live happily ever after. There really are no evers in the short-time world, happy or otherwise, a fact which Clotho and Lachesis undoubtedly knew well. They did live happily for quite some time, though. Neither of them liked to come right out and say these were the happiest years of all, because both remember their first partners in marriage with love and affection. But in their hearts, both did consider them the happiest. Ralph wasn't sure that autumn love was the richest love, but he came firmly to believe that it was the kindest and the most fulfilling. "Ah, Lois," he often said and laughed. Lois pretended to be irritated at this, but pretending was all it ever was. She saw the look in his eyes when he said it. On their first Christmas morning as man and wife, they had moved into Lois's tidy little house and put his own white rhino up for sale. Lois gave him a beagle puppy. "Do you like her?" she asked apprehensively. "I almost didn't get her. Dear Abby says you should never give pets as presents, but she looked so sweet in the pet shop window. And so sad. If you don't like her, or don't want to spend the rest of the winter trying to housebreak a puppy, just say so. We'll find someone..." "Lois," he said, giving his eyebrow what he hoped was that special ironic Bill McGovern lift. "You're babbling."
"I am?"
"You am. It's something you do when you're nervous. But you can stop being nervous right now." "I'm crazy about this lady." Nor was that an exaggeration. He fell in love with a black and tan beagle bitch almost at once.
"What will you name her?" Lois asked. "Any idea?"
"Sure," Ralph said. "Rosalie." The next 4 years were, by and large, good ones for Helen and Nat Deepnow as well. They lived frugally in an apartment on the east side of town for a while, getting along on Helen's librarian's salary, but not doing much more than that. The little Cape Cod up the street from Ralph's place had sold, but that money had gone to pay outstanding bills. Then, in June of 1994, Helen received an insurance windfall. Only the wind that blew it her way was John Lydecker. The Great Eastern Insurance Company had originally refused to pay off on Ed Deepnow's life insurance policy, claiming he had taken his own life. Then, after a great deal of harumphing and muttering under their corporate breath, they had offered a substantial settlement. They were persuaded to do this by a poker buddy of John Lydecker's named Howard Heyman. When he wasn't playing lowball, five-card stud, and three-card draw, Heyman was a lawyer who enjoyed lunching on insurance companies. Lydecker had re-met Helen at Ralph and Lois's in February of 1994, had fallen head over heels in fascination with her. "It was never quite love," he told Ralph and Lois later. which was probably just as well, considering how things turned out, and had introduced her to Haman, because he thought the insurance company was trying to screw her. He was insane, not suicidal, Lydecker said, and stuck to that long after Helen had handed him his hat and shown him the door. After being faced with a suit in which Howard Haman threatened to make Great Eastern look like Snidely Whiplash tying Little Nell to the railroad tracks, Helen had received a check for $70,000. In the late fall of 1994, she had used most of this money to buy a house on Harris Avenue, just three doors up from her old place and right across from Harriet Bennigan's. I was never really happy on the East Side, she told Lois one day in November of that year. They were on their way back from the park, and Natalie had been sitting slumped and fast asleep in her stroller, her presence little more than a pink nose tip and a fog of cold breath below a large ski hat which Lois had knitted herself. I used to dream about Harris Avenue. Isn't that crazy? I don't think dreams are ever crazy, Lois replied. Helen and John Lydecker dated for most of that summer, but neither Ralph nor Lois was particularly surprised when the courtship abruptly ended after Labor Day, or when Helen began to wear a discreet pink triangle pin on her prim, high-necked librarian's blouses. Perhaps they were not surprised, because they were old enough to have seen everything at least once, or perhaps on some deep level they were still glimpsing the auras which surround things, creating a bright gateway opening on a secret city of hidden meanings, concealed motives, and camouflaged agendas. Ralph and Lois babysat Natalie frequently after Helen moved back to Harris Avenue, and they enjoyed these stints tremendously. Nat was the child their marriage might have produced if it had happened 30 years sooner, and the coldest, most overcast winter day warmed and brightened when Natalie came toddling in, looking like a midget version of the Goodyear blimp in her pink quilted snowsuit, with the mittens hanging from the cuffs, and yelled exuberantly,
"Hi, Ralph! Hi, Wallace! I come to visit you!"
In June of 1995, Helen bought a reconditioned Volvo. On the back she put a sticker which read, "A woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle." This sentiment did not particularly surprise Ralph either, but glimpsing that sticker always made him feel unhappy. He sometimes thought Ed's meanest legacy to his widow was summed up in its brittle, not quite funny sentiment. And when he saw it, Ralph often remembered how Ed had looked on that summer afternoon when he'd walked up from the Red Apple store to confront him, how Ed had been sitting, shirtless, in the spray thrown by the sprinkler, how there had been a drop of blood on one lens of his glasses, how he had leaned forward, looking at Ralph with his earnest, intelligent eyes, and said that once stupidity reached a certain level, it became hard to live with. And after that, stuff started to happen, Ralph would sometimes think. Just what stuff was something he could no longer remember, though. And probably that was just as well. But his lapse of memory, if that's what it was, did not change his belief that Helen had been cheated in some obscure fashion, that some bad-tempered fate had tied a can to her tail, and she didn't even know it. A month after Helen bought her Volvo, Faye Chapin suffered a heart attack while drafting a preliminary list of seeds for that fall's Runway 3 Classic. He was taken to Derry Home Hospital, where he died 7 hours later. Ralph visited him shortly before the end, and when he saw the numbers on the door, 315, a fierce sense of déjà vu washed over him. At first he thought it was because Carolyn had finished her last illness just up the hall, and then he remembered that Jimmy V had died in this very room. He and Lois had visited Jimmy just before the end, and Ralph thought Jimmy had recognized them both, although he couldn't be sure. His memories of the time when he had first begun to really notice Lois were mixed up and hazy in his mind. He supposed some of that was love, and probably some of it had to do with getting on in years. But probably most of it had been the insomnia. He'd gone through a really bad patch of that in the months after Carolyn's death, although it had eventually cured itself, as such things sometimes did. Still, it seemed to him that something... Hello, woman. Hello, man. We've been waiting for you. Far out of the ordinary had happened in this room. And as he took Faye's dry, strengthless hand and smiled into Faye's frightened, confused eyes, a strange thought came to him. They're standing right over there in the corner and watching us. He looked over. There was no one at all in the corner, of course. But for a moment, for just a moment... Life in the years between 1993 and 1998 went on as life in places like Derry always does. The buds of April became the brittle blowing leaves of October. Christmas trees were brought into homes in mid-December and hauled off in the backs of dumpsters with strands of tinsel still hanging sadly from their boughs during the first week of January. Babies came in through the indoor and old folks went out through the outdoor. Sometimes people in the prime of their lives went out through the outdoor, too. In Derry, there were 5 years of haircuts and permanents, storms and senior proms, coffee and cigarettes, steak dinners at Parker's Cove, and hot dogs at the Little League Field. Girls and boys fell in love, drunks fell out of cars, short skirts fell out of favor. People reshingled their roofs and repaved their driveways. Old bums were voted out of office. New bums were voted in. It was life, often unsatisfying, frequently cruel, usually boring, sometimes beautiful, once in a while exhilarating. The fundamental things continued to apply as time went by. In the early fall of 1996, Ralph became convinced he had colon cancer. He had begun to see more than trace amounts of blood in his stool, and when he finally went to see Dr. Picard, Dr. Litchfield's cheerful, rumpled replacement. He did so with visions of hospital beds and chemotherapy IV drips dancing bleakly in his head. Instead of cancer, the problem turned out to be a hemorrhoid, which had, in Dr. Picard's memorable phrase, popped its top. He wrote Ralph a prescription for suppositories, which Ralph took to the Rite Aid down the street. Joe Weiser read it, then grinned cheerfully at Ralph. Lousy, he said. But it beats the hell out of colon cancer, don't you think? The thought of colon cancer never crossed my mind, Ralph replied stiffly. One day during the winter of 1997, Lois took it into her head to slide down her favorite hill in Strawford Park on that deep-nosed plastic flying saucer sled. She went down faster than a pig in a greased chute. This was Don Veazey's phrase. He just happened to be there that day watching the action and crashed into the side of the port-a-san marked women. She sprained her knee and twisted her back, and although Ralph knew he had no business doing so, it was unsympathetic, to say the least. He laughed hilariously most of the way to the emergency room. The fact that Lois was also howling with laughter despite the pain did nothing to help Ralph regain control. He laughed until tears poured from his eyes, and he thought he might have a stroke. She had just looked so goddamned our Lois, going down the hill on that thing, spinning around and around with her legs crossed like one of those yogis from the mysterious East, and she had almost knocked the port-a-san over when she hit it. She was completely recovered by the time spring rolled around, although that knee always ached on rainy nights, and she did get tired of Don Veazey asking, almost every time he saw her, if she'd slid into any shit houses lately. Just life, going on as it always does, which is to say mostly between the lines and outside the margins. It's what happens while we're making other plans, according to some sage or other. And if life was exceptionally good to Ralph Roberts during those years, it might have been because he had no other plans to make. He maintained friendships with Joe Weiser and John Lydecker, but his best friend during those years was his wife. They went almost everywhere together, had no secrets, and fought so seldom, one might just as well have said never. He also had Rosalie, the beagle, the rocker that had once been Mr. Chass's, and was now his, and almost daily visits from Natalie, who had begun calling them Ralph and Lois instead of Wolf and Wolf, a change neither of them found to be an improvement. And he was healthy, which was maybe the best thing of all. It was just life, full of short-time rewards and setbacks, and Ralph lived it with enjoyment and serenity until mid-March of 1998, when he awoke one morning, glanced at the digital clock beside his bed, and saw it was 5:49 a.m. He lay quietly beside Lois, not wanting to disturb her by getting up, and wondering what had awakened him. You know what, Ralph? No, I don't. Yes, you do. Listen. So he listened. He listened very carefully. And after a while, he began to hear it in the walls. The low, soft ticking of the death watch. Ralph awoke at 5:47 the following morning, and at 5:44 the morning after that. His sleep was whittled away, minute by minute, as winter slowly loosened its grip on Derry and allowed spring to find its way back in. By May, he was hearing the tick of the death watch everywhere, but understood it was all coming from one place and simply projecting itself, as a good ventriloquist can project his voice. Before, it had been coming from Carolyn. Now it was coming from him. He felt none of the terror that had gripped him when he'd been so sure he had developed cancer, and none of the desperation he vaguely remembered from his previous bout of insomnia. He tired more easily, and began to find it more difficult to concentrate and remember even simple things. But he accepted what was happening calmly. "Are you sleeping all right, Ralph?" Lois asked him one day. "You're getting these big, dark circles under your eyes." "It's the dope I take," Ralph said. "Very funny, you old poop." He took her in his arms and hugged her. "Don't worry about me, sweetheart. I'm getting all the sleep I need." He awoke one morning a week later at 4:02 a.m. with a line of deep heat throbbing in his arm, throbbing in perfect sync with the sound of the death watch, which was, of course, nothing more or less than the beat of his own heart. But this new thing wasn't his heart, or at least Ralph didn't think it was. It felt as if an electric filament had been embedded in the flesh of his forearm. "It's the scar," he thought, and then, "No, it's the promise. The time of the promise is almost here." "What promise, Ralph? What promise?" He didn't know. One day in early June, Helen and Nat blew in to visit and tell Ralph and Lois about the trip they had taken to Boston with Aunt Melanie, a bank teller with whom Helen had become close friends. Helen and Aunt Melanie had gone to some sort of feminist convention while Natalie networked with about a billion new kids in the daycare center. And then Aunt Melanie had left to do some more feminist things in New York and Washington. Helen and Nat had stayed on in Boston for a couple of days, just sightseeing. "We went to see a movie cartoon," Natalie said. "It was about animals in the woods. They talked." She pronounced this last word with Shakespearean grandiosity. "Talked." "Movies where animals talk are neat, aren't they?" Lois asked. "Yes. Also, I got this new dress." "And a very pretty dress it is," Lois said. Helen was looking at Ralph. "Are you okay, old chum? You look pale, and you haven't said boo." "Never better," he said. "I was just thinking how cute you two look in those caps. Did you get them at Fenway Park?" Both Helen and Nat were wearing Boston Red Sox caps. These were common enough in New England during warm weather, common as cat dirt, Lois would have said. But the sight of them on the heads of these two people filled Ralph with some deep, resonant feeling, and it was tied to a specific image, one he did not in the least understand, the front of the Red Apple store. Helen, meantime, had taken off her hat and was examining it. "Yes," she said. "We went, but we only stayed for three innings. Men hitting balls and catching balls. I guess I just don't have much patience for men and their balls these days. But we like our nifty bow sox hats, don't we, Natalie?" "Yes," Natalie agreed smartly. And when Ralph awoke the next morning at 4:01, the scar throbbed its thin line of heat inside his arm, and the death watch seemed almost to have gained a voice. one which whispered a strange, foreign-sounding name over and over. Atropos, Atropos, Atropos. I know that name. Do you, Ralph? Yes. He was the one with the rusty scalpel and the nasty disposition. The one who called me Shorts. The one who took what, Ralph? He was getting used to these silent discussions. They seemed to come to him on some mental radio band, a pirate frequency that operated only during the little hours, the ones when he lay awake beside his sleeping wife, waiting for the sun to come up. Took what? Do you remember? He didn't expect to. The questions that voice asked him almost always went unanswered. But this time, unexpectedly, an answer came. Bill McGovern's hat, of course. Atropos took Bill's hat, and once I made him so mad, he actually took a bite out of the brim. Who is he? Who is Atropos? Of this he was not so sure. He only knew that Atropos had something to do with Helen, who now owned a Boston Red Sox cap of which she seemed very fond, and that he had a rusty scalpel. Soon, thought Ralph Roberts as he lay in the dark, listening to the soft, steady tick of the death watch in the walls, I'll know soon. During the third week of that baking hot June, Ralph began to see the auras again. As June slipped into July, Ralph found himself bursting into tears often, usually for no discernible reason at all. It was strange. He had no sense of depression or discontent, but sometimes he would look at something, maybe only a bird winging its solitary way across the sky, and his heart would vibrate with sorrow and loss. It's almost over, the inside voice said. It no longer belonged to Carolyn or Bill, or even his own younger self. It was all its own now, the voice of a stranger, although not necessarily an unkind one. That's why you're sad, Ralph. It's perfectly normal to be sad as things start to wind down. Nothing's almost over, he cried back. Why should it be? At my last checkup, Dr. Picard said I was sound as a drum. I'm fine, never better. Silence from the voice inside. But it was a knowing silence. Okay, Ralph said out loud one hot afternoon near the end of July. He was sitting on a bench not far from a place where the Derry standpipe had stood until 1985, when the big storm had come along and knocked it down. At the base of the hill, near the birdbath, a young man, a serious birdwatcher from the binoculars he wore and a thick stack of paperbacks on the grass beside him, was making careful notes in what looked like some sort of journal. Okay, tell me why it's almost over. Just tell me that. There was no immediate answer, but that was all right. Ralph was willing to wait. It had been quite a stroll over here. The day was hot, and he was tired. He was now waking around 3:30 every morning. He had begun taking long walks again, but not in any hope they would help him sleep better or longer. He thought he was making pilgrimages, visiting all his favorite spots in Derry one last time, saying goodbye. Because the time of the promise has almost come, the voice answered, and the scar began to throb with its deep, narrow heat again. The one that was made to you, and the one you made in return. What was it? He asked, agitated. Please, if I made a promise, why can't I remember what it was? The serious birdwatcher heard that and looked up the hill. What he saw was a man sitting on a park bench and apparently having a conversation with himself. The corners of the serious birdwatcher's mouth turned down in disgust, and he thought, I hope I die before I get that old. I really do. Then he turned back to the birdbath and began making notes again. Deep inside Ralph's head, the clenching sensation, that feeling of blink, suddenly came again, and although he didn't stir from the bench, Ralph felt himself propelled rapidly upward nonetheless, faster and faster than ever before.
Not at all, the voice said. Once you were much higher than this, Ralph. Lois, too. But you're getting there. You'll be ready soon. The bird watcher, who lived all unknowing in the center of a gorgeous spun gold aura, looked around cautiously, perhaps wanting to make sure that the senile old man on the bench at the top of the hill wasn't creeping up on him with a blunt instrument. What he saw caused the tight, prissy line of his mouth to soften in astonishment. His eyes widened. Ralph observed sudden radiating spokes of indigo in the serious bird watcher's aura and realized he was looking at shock. What's the matter with him? What does he see? But that was wrong. It wasn't what the bird watcher saw. It was what he didn't see. He didn't see Ralph, because Ralph had gone up high enough to disappear from this level, had become the visual equivalent of a note blown on a dog whistle. If they were here now, I could see them easily. Who, Ralph? If who was here? Clotho, Lachesis, and Atropos. All at once, the pieces began to fly together in his mind, like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle that had looked a great deal more complicated than it actually was. Ralph, whispering, "Oh, my God! Oh, my God! Oh, my God!" Six days later, Ralph awoke at 3:15 in the morning and knew that the time of the promise had come.
"I think I'll walk up street to the Red Apple and get an ice cream bar," Ralph said. It was almost 10:00. His heart was beating much too fast, and his thoughts were hard to find under the constant white noise of terror which now filled him. He had never felt less like ice cream in his entire life, but it was a reasonable enough excuse for a trip to the Red Apple. It was the first week of August, and the weatherman had said the mercury would probably top 90 by early afternoon, with thunderstorms to follow in the early evening. Ralph thought he needn't worry about the thunderstorms. A bookcase stood on a spread of newspapers by the kitchen door. Lois had been painting it barn red. Now she got to her feet, put her hands into the small of her back, and stretched. Ralph could hear the minute crackling sounds of her spine. "I'll go with you. My head'll ache tonight if I don't get away from that paint for a while. I don't know why I wanted to paint on such a muggy day in the first place." The last thing on earth Ralph wanted was to be accompanied up to the Red Apple by Lois. "You don't have to, honey. I'll bring you back one of those coconut popsicles you like. I wasn't even planning on taking Rosalie. It's so humid. Go sit on the back porch, why don't you? Any popsicle you carry back from the store on a day like this will be falling off the stick by the time you get it here," she said. "Come on, let's go while there's still shade on this side of the..." She trailed off. The little smile she'd been wearing slipped off her face. It was replaced by a look of dismay, and the gray of her aura, which had only darkened slightly during the years Ralph hadn't been able to see it, now began to glow with flocks of reddish-pink embers. "Ralph, what's wrong? What are you really going to do?" "Nothing," he said, but the scar was glowing inside his arm, and the tick of the death watch was everywhere, loud and everywhere. It was telling him he had an appointment to keep, a promise to keep. "Yes, there is, and it's been wrong for the last 2 or 3 months, maybe longer. I'm a foolish woman. I knew something was happening, but I couldn't bring myself to look at it dead on, because I was afraid, and I was right to be afraid, wasn't I? I was right. Lois..." She was suddenly crossing the room to him, crossing fast, almost leaping, the old back injury not slowing her down in the least. And before he could stop her, she had seized his right arm and was holding it out, looking at it fixedly. The scar was glowing a fierce, bright red. Ralph had a moment to hope that it was strictly an aural glow, and she wouldn't be able to see it. Then she looked up, her eyes round and full of terror. Terror and something else. Ralph thought that something else was recognition. "Oh, my God," she whispered. "The men in the park, the ones with the funny names, clothes and lashes, something like that, and one of them cut you.
Oh, Ralph, oh, my God, what are you supposed to do?
Now, Lois, don't take on.
Don't you dare tell me not to take on, she shrieked into his face. Don't you dare, don't you dare.
Hurry, the interior voice whispered. You don't have time to stand around and discuss this. Somewhere it's already begun to happen, and the death watch you hear may not be ticking just for you. I have to go. He turned and blundered toward the door. In his agitation, he did not notice a certain Sherlock Holmesian circumstance attending this scene. A dog which should have barked. A dog which always barked her stern disapproval when voices were raised in this house, but did not. Rosalie was missing from her usual place by the screen door, and the door itself was standing ajar. Rosalie was the first thing from Ralph's mind at that moment. He felt knee-deep in molasses and thought he would be doing well just to make the porch, let alone the red apple up the street. His heart thumped and skidded in his chest. His eyes were burning.
No, Lois screamed. No, Ralph, please, please don't leave me.
She ran after him, clutched his arm. She was still holding her paintbrush, and the fine red droplets which splattered his shirt looked like blood. Now she was crying, and her expression of utter, abject sorrow nearly broke his heart. He didn't want to leave her like this. Wasn't sure he could leave her like this. He turned and took her by her forearms. Lois, I have to go.
You haven't been sleeping, she babbled. I knew that, and I knew it meant something was wrong, but it doesn't matter. We'll go away. We can leave right now, this minute. We'll just take Rosalie and our toothbrushes and go.
He squeezed her arms and she stopped, looking up at him with her wet eyes. Her lips were trembling. Lois, listen to me. I have to do this.
I lost Paul. I can't lose you, too, she wailed. I couldn't stand it. Oh, Ralph, I couldn't stand it.
You'll be able to, he thought. Short-timers are a lot tougher than they look. They have to be. Ralph felt a couple of tears trickle down his cheeks. He suspected their source was more weariness than grief. If he could make her see that all this changed nothing, only made what he had to do harder. He held her at arm's length. The scar on his arm was throbbing more fiercely than ever, and the feeling of time slipping relentlessly away had become overwhelming.
Walk with me at least part way, if you want, he said. Maybe you can even help me do what I have to do. I've had my life, Lois, and a fine one it was. But she hasn't really had anything yet, and I'll be damned if I let that son of a bitch have her just because he's got a score to settle with me.
What son of a bitch? Ralph, what in the world are you talking about?
I'm talking about Natalie Deepnow. She's supposed to die this morning, only I'm not going to let that happen.
Nat? Ralph, why would anyone want to hurt Nat?
She looked very bewildered, very our Lois. But wasn't there something else beneath that daffy exterior? Something careful and calculating? Ralph thought the answer was yes. Ralph had an idea Lois wasn't half as bewildered as she was pretending to be. She had fooled McGovern for years with that act. Him, too, at least part of the time. And this was just another, and rather brilliant, variation of the same old scam. What she was really trying to do was hold him here. She loved Nat deeply, but to Lois, a choice between her husband and the little girl who lived up the lane was no choice at all. She didn't consider either age or questions of fairness to have any bearing on the situation. Ralph was her man, and to Lois, that was all that mattered. It won't work, he said, not unkindly. He disengaged himself and started for the door again. I made a promise, and I'm all out of time.
Break it, then, she cried, and the mixture of terror and rage in her voice stunned him. I don't remember much about that time, but I remember we got involved with things that almost got us killed, and for reasons we couldn't even understand. So break it, Ralph. Better your promise than my heart.
And what about the kid? What about Helen, for that matter? That's all she lives for. Doesn't Helen deserve something better from me than a broken promise?
I don't care what she deserves, what any of them deserve, she shouted. and then her face crumpled. Yes, all right, I suppose I do. But what about us, Ralph? Don't we count? Her eyes, those dark and eloquent Spanish eyes of hers, pleaded with him. If he looked into them too long, it would become all too easy to cry it off. So Ralph looked away. I mean to do it, honey. And that's going to get what you and I have already had. Another 70 years or so of days and nights. She looked at him helplessly, but made no attempt to stop him again. Instead, she began to cry. Foolish old man, she whispered. Foolish, willful old man. Yes, I suppose, he said, and lifted her chin. But I'm a foolish, willful old man of my word. Come with me. I'd like that. All right, Ralph. She could hardly hear her own voice, and her skin was as cold as clay. Her aura had gone almost completely red. What is it? What's going to happen to her? She's going to be hit by a green Ford sedan. Unless I take her place, she's going to be splashed all over Harris Avenue. And Helen's going to see it happen. As they walked up the hill toward the Red Apple, at first Lois kept falling behind, then trotting to catch up. But she quit when she saw she could not slow him with such a simple trick. Ralph told her what little more he could. She had some memory of being under the lightning-struck tree out by the extension, a memory she had believed, at least until this morning, to be the memory of a dream. But of course she hadn't been there during Ralph's final confrontation with Atropos. Ralph told her of it now, of the random death Atropos intended Natalie to suffer if Ralph continued standing in the way of his plans. He told her of how he'd extracted a promise from Clotho and Lachesis that Atropos might in this case be overruled, and Nat saved. I have an idea that the decision was made very near the top of this crazy building. This tower they kept talking about. Maybe at the very top. He was panting out the words, and his heart was beating more rapidly than ever. But he thought most of that could be attributed to the fast walk and the torrid day. His fear had subsided somewhat. Talking to Lois had done that much. Now he could see the Red Apple. Mrs. Perrine was at the bus stop, half a block farther up, standing straight as a general, reviewing troops. Her net shopping bag hung over her arm. There was a bus shelter nearby, and it was shady inside, but Mrs. Perrine stolidly ignored its existence. Even in the dazzling sunlight, he could see that her aura was the same West Point gray as it had been on that October evening in 1993. Of Helen and Nat, there was as yet no sign.
Of course I knew who he was, Esther Perrine later tells the reporter from the Derry News. Do I look incompetent to you, young man, or senile? I've known Ralph Roberts for over 20 years. A good man. Not cut from the same cloth as his first wife, of course. Carolyn was a Satterwaite from the Bangor Satterwaites, but a very fine man just the same. I recognized the driver of that green Ford auto, too, right away. Pete Sullivan delivered my paper for 6 years, and he did a good job. The new one, the Morrison boy, always throws it in my flower beds or up on the porch roof. Pete was driving with his mother on his learner's permit, I understand. I hope he won't take on too much about what happened, for he's a good lad, and it really wasn't his fault. I saw the whole thing, and I'll take my oath on it. I suppose you think I'm rambling. Don't bother denying it. I can read your face just like it was your own newspaper. Never mind, though. I've said most of what I have to say. I knew it was Ralph right away. But there's something you'll get wrong, even if you put it in your story, which you probably won't. He came from nowhere to save that little girl.
Esther Perrine fixes the respectfully silent young reporter with a formidable glance. Fixes him as a lepidopterist might fix a butterfly on a pin after administering the chloroform.
I don't mean it was like he came from nowhere, young man, although I bet that's what you'll print.
She leans toward the reporter, her eyes never leaving his face, and says it again.
He came
came from nowhere to save that little girl. Do you follow me? From nowhere.
The accident made the front page of the following day's Derry News. Esther Perrine was sufficiently colorful in her remarks to warrant a sidebar of her own, and staff photographer Tom Matthews got a picture to go with it that made her look like Ma Jode in The Grapes of Wrath. The headline of the sidebar read, "It was like he came from nowhere. Eyewitness to tragedy says." When she read it, Mrs. Perrine was not at all surprised. "In the end, I got what I wanted," Ralph said. "But only because Clotho and Lachesis, and whoever it is they work for on the upper levels, were desperate to stop Ed."
"Upper levels? What upper levels? What building?"
"Never mind. You've forgotten, but remembering wouldn't change anything. The point is just this, Lois. They didn't want to stop Ed because thousands of people would have died if he'd hit the Civic Center dead on. They wanted to stop him because there was one person whose life needed to be preserved at any cost, in their reckoning anyway. When I was finally able to make them see that I felt the same about my kid as they did about theirs, arrangements were made."
"That's when they cut you, wasn't it? And when you made the promise, the one you used to talk about in your sleep."
He shot her a wide-eyed, startled, and heartbreakingly boyish glance. She only looked back. "Yes," he said, and wiped his forehead. "I guess so." The air lay in his lungs like metal shavings. "A life for a life. That was the deal. Natalie's in exchange for mine, and..."
"Hey, quit trying to wiggle away. Quit it, Rover, or I'll kick your asshole square."
Ralph broke off at the sound of that shrill, hectoring, horridly familiar voice. A voice no human being on Harris Avenue but him could hear. And looked across the street.
"Ralph, what?"
"Shh." He pulled her back against the summer dry hedge in front of the Applebaum's house. He wasn't doing anything so polite as perspiring now. His whole body was crawling with a stinking sweat as heavy as engine oil, and he could feel every gland in his body dumping a hot load into his blood. His underwear was trying to crawl up into the crack of his ass and disappear. His tongue tasted like a blown fuse. Lois followed the direction of his gaze.
"Rosalie," she cried. "Rosalie, you bad dog. What are you doing over there?"
The black and tan beagle she had given Ralph on their first Christmas was across the street, standing, except cringing was actually the word for what she was doing, on the sidewalk in front of the house where Helen and Nat had lived until Ed had popped his wig. For the first time in the years they'd had her, the beagle reminded Lois of Rosalie Number One. Rosalie Number Two appeared to be all alone over there, but that did not allay Lois's sudden terror.
"Oh, what have I done?" she thought. "What have I done?" "Rosalie!" she screamed. "Rosalie, get over here!"
The dog heard. Lois could see that she did, but she didn't move.
"Ralph, what's happening over there?"
"Shh," he said again, and then just a little farther up the street, Lois saw something which stopped her breath. Her last unstated hope that all this was happening only in Ralph's head, that it was a kind of flashback to their previous experience, disappeared because now their dog had company. Holding a skip rope looped over her right arm, 6-year-old Nat Deepnoe came to the end of her walk and looked down the street toward a house she didn't remember ever living in, toward a lawn where her shirtless father, an undesignated player named Ed Deepnoe, had once sat among intersecting rainbows, listening to the Jefferson Airplane as a single spot of blood dried on his John Lennon spectacles. Natalie looked down the street and smiled happily at Rosalie, who was panting and watching her with miserable, frightened eyes. "Atropos doesn't see me," Ralph thought. "He's concentrating on Rosie, and on Natalie, of course, and he doesn't see me." Everything had come around with a sort of hideous perfection. The house was there, Rosalie was there, and Atropos was there too, wearing a hat cocked back on his head and looking like a wiseacre news reporter in a 1950s B picture, something directed by Ida Lupino, perhaps. Only this time, it wasn't a Panama with a bite gone from the brim. This time, it was a Boston Red Sox cap, and it was too small even for Atropos, because the adjustable band in the back had been pulled all the way over to the last hole. It had to be, in order to fit the head of the little girl who owned it. All we need now is Pete the paperboy, and the show would be perfect, Ralph thought. The final scene of Insomnia, or Short Time Life on Harris Avenue, a tragicomedy in three acts. Everyone takes a bow and then exits stage right. This dog was afraid of Atropos, just as Rosalie No. 1 had been, and the main reason the little bald doc hadn't seen Ralph and Lois was that he was trying to keep her from running off before he was ready. And here came Nat, headed down the sidewalk toward her favorite dog in the whole world, Ralph and Lois's Rosie. Her jump rope, 369, hun, the goose drank wine, was slung over her arm. She looked impossibly beautiful and impossibly fragile in her sailor shirt and blue shorts. Her pigtails bounced. It's happening too fast, Ralph thought. Everything is happening much too fast.
Not at all, Ralph. You did splendidly 5 years ago. You'll do splendidly now.
It sounded like Clotho, but there was no time to look. A green car was coming slowly down Harris Avenue from the direction of the airport, moving with a sort of agonized care which usually meant a driver who was very old or very young. Agonized care or not, it was unquestionably the car. A dirty membrane hung over it like a shroud. Life is a wheel, Ralph thought, and it occurred to him that this was not the first time the idea had occurred to him. Sooner or later, everything you thought you'd left behind comes around again. For good or ill, it comes around again. Rosie made another abortive lunge for freedom, and as Atropos yanked her back, losing his hat, Nat knelt before her and patted her.
Are you lost, girl? Did you get out by yourself? That's okay. I'll take you home.
She gave Rosie a hug, her small arms passing through Atropos's arms, her small, beautiful face only inches from his ugly, grinning one. Then she got up.
Come on, Rosie. Come on, sugar pie.
Rosalie started down the sidewalk at Nat's heel, looking back once at the grinning little man and whining uneasily. On the other side of Harris Avenue, Helen came out of the Red Apple, and the last condition of the vision Atropos had shown Ralph was fulfilled. Helen had a loaf of bread in one hand. Her Red Sox hat was on her head. Ralph swept Lois into his arms and kissed her fiercely. I love you with all my heart, he said. Remember that, Lois. I know you do, she said calmly. And I love you. That's why I can't let you do it. She seized him around the neck, her arms like bands of iron, and he felt her breasts push against him hard as she drew in all the breath her lungs could hold.
Go away, you rotten bastard, she screamed. I can't see you, but I know you're there. Go away! Go away and leave us alone!
Natalie stopped dead in her tracks and looked at Lois with wide-eyed surprise. Rosalie stopped beside her, ears pricking.
Don't go into the street, Nat! Lois screamed at her. Don't!
Then her hands, which had been laced together at the back of Ralph's neck, were holding nothing. Her arms, which had been locked about his shoulders in a death grip, were empty. He was gone like smoke. Atropos looked toward the cry of alarm and saw Ralph and Lois standing on the other side of Harris Avenue. More important, he saw Ralph seeing him. His eyes widened, his lips parted in a hateful snarl. One hand flew to his bald pate. It was crisscrossed with old scars, the remnants of wounds made with his own scalpel, in an instinctive gesture of defense that was 5 years too late.
Fuck you, Shorts! This little bitch is mine!
Ralph saw Nat looking at Lois with uncertainty and surprise. He heard Lois shrieking at her, telling her not to go into the street. Then it was Lachesis he heard, speaking from some place close by.
Come up, Ralph. As far as you can, quickly.
He felt the clench in the center of his head, felt that brief swoop of vertigo in his stomach, and suddenly the whole world brightened and filled with color. He half saw and half felt Lois's arms and locked hands collapse inward, through the place where his body had been a moment before. And then he was drawing away from her. No, being carried away from her. He felt the pull of some great current, and understood, in a vague way, that if there was such a thing as a higher purpose, he had joined it, and would soon be swept downriver with it. Natalie and Rosalie were now standing directly in front of the house which Ralph had once shared with Bill McGovern before selling up and moving into Lois's house. Nat glanced doubtfully at Lois, then waved tentatively.
"She's okay, Lois. See, she's right here." She patted Rosalie's head. "I'll cross her safe. Don't worry."
Then as she started into the street, she called to her mother.
"I can't find my baseball cap. I think somebody stole it."
Rosalie was still on the sidewalk. Nat turned to her impatiently.
"Come on, girl."
The green car was moving in the child's direction, but very slowly. It did not at first look like much of a danger to her. Ralph recognized the driver at once, and he did not doubt his senses or suspect he was having a hallucination. In that instant, it seemed very right that the approaching sedan should be piloted by his old paper boy.
"Natalie!"
Lois screamed.
"Natalie! No!"
Atropos darted forward and slapped Rosalie number two on the rump.
"Get out of here, mutt! Go on, before I change my mind!"
Atropos spared Ralph one final grimacing leer as Rosalie yelped and darted into the street, and into the path of the Ford driven by 16-year-old Pete Sullivan. Natalie didn't see the car. She was looking at Lois, whose face was all red and scary. It had finally occurred to Nat that Lois wasn't screaming about Rosie at all, but something else entirely. Pete registered the sprinting beagle. It was the little girl he didn't see. He swerved to avoid Rosalie, a maneuver that ended with a Ford aimed directly at Natalie. Ralph could see two frightened faces behind the windshield as the car veered, and he thought Mrs. Sullivan was screaming. Atropos was leaping up and down, doing an obscenely joyful hornpipe.
"Yeah! Short time! Silly white hair! Told you I'd fix you!"
In slow motion, Helen dropped the loaf of bread she was holding.
"Natalie, look out!"
she shrieked. Ralph ran. Again there was that clear sensation of moving by thought alone, and as he closed in on Nat, now diving forward with his hands stretched out, aware of the car looming just beyond her, kicking bright arrows of sun through its dark death bag and into his eyes, he clenched his mind again, bringing himself back down to the short-time world for the last time. He fell into a landscape that rang with splintered screams. Helen's mingled with Lois's, mingled with the ones being made by the tires of the Ford. Weaving its way through them like an outlaw vine was the sound of Atropos's jeers. Ralph got a brief glimpse of Nat's wide blue eyes, and then he shoved her in the chest and stomach as hard as he could, sending her flying backward with her hands and feet thrust out in front of her. She landed sitting up in the gutter, bruising her tailbone on the curb, but breaking nothing. From some distant place, Ralph heard Atropos squawk in fury and disbelief. Then 2 tons of Ford, still traveling at 20 miles an hour, struck Ralph, and the soundtrack dropped dead. He was heaved upward and backward in a low, slow arc. It felt slow, anyway from inside, and went with the Ford's hood ornament imprinted on his cheek like a tattoo, and one broken leg trailing behind him. There was time to see his shadow sliding along the pavement beneath him in a shape like an X. There was time to see a spray of red droplets in the air just above him, and to think that Lois must have splattered more paint on him than he had thought at first. And there was time to see Natalie sitting at the side of the street, weeping but all right, and to sense Atropos on the sidewalk behind her, shaking his fists and dancing with rage. "I believe I did pretty damn good for an old geezer," Ralph thought. "But now I think I could really do with a nap." Then he came back to earth with a terrible mortal smack and rolled, skull fracturing, back breaking, lungs punctured by brittle thorns of bone as his rib cage exploded, liver turning to pulp, intestines first coming unanchored and then rupturing. And nothing hurt. Nothing at all. Lois never forgot the awful thud that was the sound of Ralph's return to Harris Avenue, or the bloody splash marks he left behind as he cartwheeled to a stop. She wanted to scream, but dared not. Some deep, true voice told her that if she did that, the combination of shock, horror, and summer heat would send her unconscious to the sidewalk, and when she came to again, Ralph would be beyond her. She ran instead of screaming, losing one shoe, marginally aware that Pete Sullivan was getting out of the Ford, which had come to rest almost exactly where Joe Wise's car, also a Ford, had come to rest after Joe had hit Rosalie number one all those years ago. She was also marginally aware that Pete was screaming. She reached Ralph and fell on her knees beside him, seeing that his shape had somehow been changed by the green Ford, that the body beneath the familiar chino pants and paint-splattered shirt was fundamentally different from the body which had been pressed against hers less than a minute ago. But his eyes were open, and they were bright and aware. Ralph? Yes. His voice was clear and strong, unmarked by either confusion or pain. Yes, Lois, I hear you. She started to put her arms around him and hesitated, thinking about how you weren't supposed to move people who had been badly injured because you might hurt them even worse or kill them. Then she looked at him again, at the blood pouring from the sides of his mouth and the way his lower body seemed to have come unhinged from the upper part, and decided it would be impossible to hurt Ralph more than he had been hurt already. She hugged him, leaning close, leaning into the smells of disaster, blood and the sweet, sour acetone odor of spent adrenaline on the outrush of his breath. "You did it this time, didn't you?" Lois asked. She kissed his cheek, his blood-soaked eyebrows, his bloody forehead, where the skin had been peeled away from his skull in a flap. She began to cry.
"Look at you. Shirt torn, pants torn. Do you think clothes grow on trees?"
"Is he all right?" Helen asked from behind her. Lois didn't turn around, but she saw the shadows on the street. Helen with her arm around her weeping daughter's shoulders, and Rosie standing by Helen's right leg.
"He saved Nat's life, and I didn't even see where he came from. Please, Lois, say he's all right."
Then the shadow shifted, as Helen moved to a place where she could actually see Ralph, and she pulled Nat's face against her blouse and began to wail. Lois leaned closer to Ralph, caressing his cheeks with the palms of her hands, wanting to tell him that she had meant to come with him. She had meant to, yes, but in the end he had been too quick for her. In the end he had left her behind. "Love you, sweetheart," Ralph said. He reached up and copied her gesture with his own palm. He tried to raise his left hand as well, but it would only lie on the pavement and twitch. Lois took his hand and kissed it.
"Love you too, Ralph. Always. So much."
"I had to do it, you see?" "Yes." She didn't know if she did see, didn't know if she would ever see, but she knew he was dying.
"Yes, I see."
He sighed harshly. That sweet acetone smell wafted up to her again, and smiled.
"Miss Chess, Miss Roberts, I mean."
It was Pete speaking in hitching gasps.
Is Mr. Roberts okay? Please say I didn't hurt him."
"Stay away, Pete," she said without turning around. "Ralph is fine. He just tore his pants and shirt a little. Didn't you, Ralph?"
"Yes," he said. "You bet. You just have to horsewhip me for..."
He broke off and looked to her left. No one was there, but Ralph smiled anyway. "Lachesis," he said. He put out his trembling, blood-grimy right hand, and as Lois, Helen, and Pete Sullivan watched, it rose and fell twice in the empty air. Ralph's eyes moved again, this time to the right. Slowly, very slowly, he moved his hand in that direction. When he spoke this time, his voice had begun to fade.
"Hi, Clotho. Now remember, this doesn't hurt, right?"
Ralph appeared to listen and then smiled.
"Yep," he whispered. "Any way you can get her."
His hand rose and fell again in the air, then dropped back to his chest. He looked up at Lois with his fading blue eyes.
Listen, he said, speaking with great effort. Yet his eyes blazed, would not let us go. Every day I woke up next to you was like waking up young and seeing everything new. He tried to raise his hand to her cheek again and could not. Every day, Lois. It was like that for me too, Ralph. Like waking up young. Lois?
What?
The ticking, he said. He swallowed and then said it again, enunciating the words with great effort.
The ticking.
What ticking?
Never mind. It stopped, he said, and smiled brilliantly. Then Ralph stopped too.
Clotho and Lachesis stood watching Lois weep over the man who lay dead in the street. In one hand, Clotho held his scissors. He raised the other to eye level and looked at it wonderingly. It glowed and blazed with Ralph's aura. Clotho.
He's here. In here. How wonderful.
Lachesis raised his own right hand. Like Clotho's left, it looked as if someone had pulled a blue mitten over the normal green-gold aura which swaddled it. Lachesis.
Yes, he was a wonderful man.
Clotho.
Shall we give him to her?
Lachesis.
Can we?
Clotho.
There's one way to find out.
They approached Lois, each placed the hand Ralph had shaken on one side of Lois's face.
Mommy,
Natalie Deepnot cried. In her agitation, she had reverted to the patois of her babyhood.
Who those little men? Why they touching Lois?
Shh, honey, Helen said, and buried Nat's head against her breast again. There were no men, little or otherwise, near Lois Roberts. She was kneeling alone in the street next to the man who had saved her daughter's life. Lois looked up suddenly, her eyes wide and surprised, a grief forgotten as a gorgeous feeling of light, blue light. Calmness and peace filled her. For a moment, Harris Avenue was gone. She was in a dark place filled with the sweet smells of hay and cows, a dark place that was split by 100 brilliant seams of light. She never forgot the fierce joy that leaped up in her at that moment, nor the sure sense that she was seeing a representation of a universe that Ralph wanted her to see, a universe where there was dazzling light behind the darkness. Couldn't she see it through the cracks?
Can you ever forgive me?
Pete was sobbing.
Oh, my God! Can you ever forgive me?
Oh, yes. I think so, Lois said calmly. She passed her hand down Ralph's face, closing his eyes, and then held his head in her lap and waited for the police to come. To Lois, Ralph looked as if he had gone to sleep. And, she saw, the long white scar on his right forearm was gone.